Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, "Hey, can I be a member and be initiated?" With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
It's Friday. It's 1 minute past five, and welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday the 22nd of October 2021, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Tonight, COVID and climate. We'll be looking at both of those in part two, with so much of today's government and mass media adopting a gang mentality, creating a hostile environment not just for diesel cars, which a few years ago were supposed to be far greener than petrol, remember that? Creating also a hostile environment for the masses, the population too. So what if we have one of their top analysts, one of the people that keeps secret everything and hand it to our policymakers, cutting through the propaganda to the information we really need to understand what they're doing to us, how we can make the best health decisions, for example, for ourselves and for our loved ones? What if one of their top analysts were working for us? Well, the good news is many of them are. It's just that they're being censored, because they don't harmonise with the big lies, the fake consensus. And the mission this show is on is to bring you some of those brilliant censored voices week after week. In the background to all of this, my Conspiracy Classics series, which aims to give you the historical bigger picture too. Tonight, an extract on Hypnotised Assassins. That is number 15 in the Conspiracy Classics series. We're up to 15 now. Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, with Laurent Guillenot from France. So all that in part two. But first of all, Ismail Abedi, the brother of the so-called Manchester Arena bomber, Salman Abedi, he manages to, first of all, get on an aircraft, and then he's told, oh, you can't fly because you're wanted in court. And the next day he goes to the airport and flies out of the country. Now, why has the head of MI5 not been sacked? What the hell is going on? This guy is supposedly a key witness in this court case of the Manchester Arena terror attack, and someone has just said, oh, it's okay, he can fly out of the country and then escape justice. Well, it may be that he was just there as a witness. Maybe he had nothing to do with it, but the idea that he's being allowed to flee the country is unbelievable. Also, our very own Labour Blairite Mayor, Marvin Rees, talking about transport here in the city. This city is in a state address, I call it. It's the annual State of the City address. And I did contact some of the politicians in the city, a couple, on Thursday, yesterday, this week, to see if they would like to come in and talk about it. And, well, no, we've been booted off FM, so why should they bother? Well, they can't make it, actually. A Lib Dem and a Conservative did reply to me, or the Labour person didn't. And also a guy called Councillor John Moss in London. For years, actually about 5 or 6 years now, he's been running a campaign called Stop ULEZ, which is looking at the emissions charge, which is on Monday about to be imposed on London. You'll be glad to hear there's a resistance rally at Elephant and Castle at noon on Monday, where people in their cars are going to drive across London without paying this ULEZ. I think down, Piers Corbyn said, to Thamesmead, which is a big, big supporter of Piers Corbyn. And a lot of people in Thamesmead are really annoyed about being included in this new ULEZ. It's a £12.50 daily charge. And we'll be talking to the Stop ULEZ campaigner, Councillor John Moss, who's been doing this for quite a long time, looking at all that first. But Martin, I think we'd probably better start off. I just think it's this got to be the story of the week, really, which is this amazing witness in the Manchester Arena trial. The brother of the so-called bomber is just allowed to get on a plane. Then he's told, oh, no, you can't fly out of the country. You're a key witness in a terror trial. And the next day he goes on the plane and escapes Britain and escapes any kind of involvement in this justice. So what on earth is going on?
Well, the first point, Tony, obviously, is it's not a trial, it's an inquest. So let's just clarify that before we go any further. And obviously the suspicion has to be that he has been allowed out of the country because he's associated with the Islamic Fighting Group, which they all associated with, which is in fact a protege of our own intelligence services.
Okay, it's actually
as the father of the brothers said in Libya after the bombing. And he'd been working with MI6. He'd gone back from Manchester to Libya to fight with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group against Gaddafi, cooperating no doubt with our own special forces. And he said from Libya that this is a fix by MI6. Because, you know, we've been cooperating with MI6 and this is, my son has been set up here. He then disappeared to Turkey. And the brother is now being allowed to escape, if you like, because if he went to the inquest, it would become clear that the links between the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and the British intelligence services are intimate and were intimate at the time of the bombing, because they've been reactivated to fight Gaddafi after the Operation Southern Mistral 2011, which was, of course, the provocation of, you know, the supposedly airstrikes on unarmed protesters, etc.
Okay, so just actually, neither of us are right. It's actually an inquiry, a public inquiry going on into this. But he had actually received a summons in July this year to attend the hearing, and then promptly fled the country. He tried the first day, the second day, he managed it. So they knew he was trying to get out of the country, but nothing happened to him. He was just allowed to flee. So someone has just said, okay, let's let him go. But there, someone is probably part of the secret services. Or the you know, passport, whoever they are, security. So it's Neil Basu's lot, you know, the Wayne Cousins squad who've been investigating the murder of the Conservative MP last Friday, who have done this. Now, it just seems almost all roads point to Neil Basu. He's the assistant commissioner of the Met, who's in charge of anti-terror work and also royal protection and that kind of thing, diplomatic protection. We never see hide nor heel of him on the TV explaining any of this, but yet again it's him, and he's still in his job. The director general of MI5 is still in their job. The families are throwing up their hands and saying, what on earth is going on? So the police also failed to inform the inquiry until the last day in August, about 6 weeks ago, that he had fled the country. So the police, not only is he been allowed to flee the country, the police that were supposed to be in charge of that, rather than telling the inquiry judge, have just forgot to for a month and a half, 2 months nearly.
Well, as you say, there's a great deal of suspicion here that they're covering something up. It may be that he's just managed to flee the country and escape the summons.
Well, you could say that, couldn't you, if it had happened just the one day. Yeah. But then he went back the next day and they let him fly out.
Yeah, it's probably because an executive order has been made at some level that he's got to be out of the country. Because if he goes to the inquiry, then questions might be raised about the links between the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and the intelligence
services. Well, yeah, I think that's the reason why they don't want him in there. And maybe they've just put the frighteners on him, said, well, you better go escape from the country. And so he's decided to do that. But, I mean, it's quite obvious the way this works. So there's an umming and ahhing about whether he should go out of the country over a couple of days. Somebody at maybe some sort of junior level has said, no, he shouldn't be allowed to flee the country. It's obviously been flagged up, kicked upstairs, and whoever is the higher authority in the police and security services has said, yeah, let's let him get out, you know, let him flee the country.
Well, there's bound to be a tension between what you might call common or garden policing and the intelligence service operations. And it may well be that, you know, the officially, you know, we want the people who are running the inquiry have said that we want him to be there and we must. And then other people are saying, psh, psh, no, we don't want him to be there. And, you know, these kind of tensions are almost inevitable given the murky nature of what we're talking about.
It hasn't always been quite like this, though, surely. I mean, trials have been able to take place without the terrorist murderers escaping the country.
Well, that's true, well, but I mean...
Let's just be clear, you know, he's there to give evidence, not because he's believed to have been one of the people actually who carried out the attack.
Well, what he said is that he fled the country because he didn't want to incriminate himself. And, of course, what the father of the brothers said, and he was working with MI6 in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group inside Libya. He'd been in Manchester, he'd gone back to Libya to fight, as had his sons, and as soon as the bombing happened, he said, this is a stitch-up by MI6, because we've been working with MI6 to overthrow Gaddafi. Now, he was then taken into custody by some militia or other, and then disappeared, and apparently he went to Turkey. Now, what people have got to understand, the most fundamental thing they need to understand, is that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are definitely based in Manchester. They've been based in Manchester since the 1980s. They were involved in the Gaddafi plot, which was blown open by Shaler and Mashal. And they need to understand that this particular attack has all the hallmarks of a false flag terror attack. Whereas what happened to Martin Amis looked much more like, not Martin Amis, but David Amis, looks much more like somebody lone wolf done
really?
Online.
Oh, does
well,
it?
Well, we don't know.
Do you believe in lone wolves?
I do, yes.
I don't.
No, I do, because they can also be recruited by online. The question is, who recruited them online? The same
well,
as with Shaman Abegin.
If there's someone being managing them, even online, they're not really a lone wolf.
Well, indeed.
This is, I think,
indeed,
a bit of a
Islamic,
myth.
And the Islamic State has got links with the intelligence services, as we know.
Do you remember Anders Breivik? We were told again and again, this is a lone wolf, this is a lone wolf.
Yep.
All the connections that he had with, for example, meetings with the founders of the English Defence League, things like this. You know, he was in a Freemasons lodge in Norway. Quite clearly, he has links with people in there that are clandestine and hidden. The idea that the links with others are hidden doesn't mean they're not there.
I'm just suggesting that the bombing in Manchester, not least because there was a viable bomb that had been built by somebody who knew how to build bombs, clearly was not a lone wolf operation. Now, in actual fact, all of these things are on a spectrum, and it may, it's logically possible that there may be lone wolves. It doesn't mean that every lone wolf is a lone wolf.
So why are we waiting until next March to have this guy's trial? It does seem like an open and shut case.
It's not a trial, it's an inquiry.
No, into the murderer of Sir David Amis, who we're told the suspect is Ali Harbi.
Well, I don't know. I mean, presumably, they want to make sure that they get all the evidence that they want in order to convict him. You better ask them, not me.
It seems a very long time. But anyway, what did you make of the actual circumstances around that murder? It's pretty horrific. One of the things we're going to be hearing a bit later on is about the length of time that he was left without being taken to hospital when he bled to death in the church, apparently. He would have been one of the major speakers on Tuesday this week at the renewal of the Coronavirus Act, against the renewal of the Act. So that was he was one of the main people who was speaking about all sorts of things to do with against the infringements on civil liberties that we've seen since the beginning of the whole COVID business. So it does seem as if there may be a political motive there. The other thing is that, you know, it looked to me, well, as soon as I saw it, like some kind of, you know, this guy's maybe even, you know, a kind of Manchurian candidate. That what was he up to? Why did he need to kill this guy? What was the motive?
Well, there's lots of information that we don't have, and some of it's coming out. His father apparently was a moderate Muslim politician from Somalia who was actually involved in Prevent. So that's a straw in the wind. It may well be, if he isn't a lone wolf and he's being directed by the intelligence services, that they will have their own, they want these things to happen so that they can carry on saying we need more powers to do X, Y, and Z. And that will be the motive from their point of view if that's what happened. But we can't just jump to conclusions, Tony.
We certainly can't. No, we don't do that here. What we do is we speculate about what might be going on in the light of some of the previous things. Indeed. Like terrorist attacks in the UK, which seem to be happening at an alarming rate, particularly political attacks around politics. Like, you know, it's not so surprising to suggest that maybe he was eliminated because he was going to be contributing to this debate on Tuesday, when we've seen the general election, for example, in 2017, a whole load of three different terrorist attacks in just a couple of weeks running up to that general election. It does seem there is a link between this kind of, I don't know if we should call it terrorism. Maybe it's just an ordinary murder, who knows? But it certainly seems to be politically motivated, and it does seem to be linked to political decisions.
Well, these are, you're taking various steps there. I would say, yes, you can say that, but I don't think the evidence leads us to a firm conclusion either way.
No, I'd agree. Anyway, so let's have a listen to the what went on in the Houses of Parliament earlier this week on Tuesday, as the six-month extension was passed. And this is a debate which Sir David Amess would almost certainly have been one of the lead speakers at on Tuesday. What happened was there was a debate and a discussion, fairly brief, and then the Madam Deputy Speaker decided that she was going to nod it through without a vote. And so let's have a listen to what happened there, because I think it's quite indicative of a sort of flippant attitude there seems to be these days in the House of Commons about what is actually a very important act of Parliament, which is massively restricting people's civil liberties.
The question is motion number 4, as on the order paper. As many as are of that opinion say aye.
Aye!
Of the contrary, no.
Aye! Aye!
Could I have the noes again?
No!
I'm afraid, I fear, the mood of the House is not to have a vote on this. I do understand. I think the Honourable Gentleman would have to rustle up a few more people to really get the sense that we required a vote when we do.
She'll live by faith.
I'm sure they will. So I think the ayes have it, the ayes. Thank you.
So that's Eleanor Lang, Madam Deputy Speaker, with a rather flippant attitude. I mean, there's people, the MPs who obviously wanted the renewal of the Coronavirus Act, shouting, screaming at the top of their voice over the nose, Martin. Well, that's not correct procedure.
It is correct procedure in our House of Commons, Tony, going back hundreds of years. Votes are only called if it's clear that there is a division.
You weren't actually listening to what I said. I'm talking about whether the eyes shout over the top of the nose. They don't.
No.
They're not allowed to do that.
Well, they've done it. And in actual fact, it's actually... It is an absurdity. In other parts of Europe, for example, that would not be an acceptable way to make a decision. But in glorious Blighty, that's regarded as the way we do things.
We have lots of shouting at the European Parliament. You're trying to make out it's different.
In the European Parliament, there is no basis for people. They always have a vote, an electronic vote. And in Polish Parliament or any other Parliament, that's what they do. In our Parliament, which is based upon public school debating rules, it's all a bit of a shouting match. In other parts of the world, it isn't like that. People think that's normal. It ain't.
Well, it certainly isn't. No, and it's not normal here either, actually.
No, it is normal here.
No, it isn't. I've never heard in all my, 40 years or something of journalism, where the people who are voting yes are allowed to shout over the top of the people voting no in order to try and drown them out. I've never seen or heard it before.
There shouldn't be a shouting match at all, Tony.
No, I agree. Well, that's what I'm saying. You're making my point for me.
That's why we need to change the constitution of the country.
All you need is a decent chair who enforces the rules of the House.
No, we need to change the constitution.
No, you need to change the chair.
Well, we're not going to agree about that.
Well,
I want to change the constitution, you don't. I do.
Well, I probably do as well, actually, but not necessarily in the same way as you. Eleanor Lang is her name, and so that's Madam Deputy Speaker for you, allowing that new law to go through earlier this week. So what about the implications of this, though? The Coronavirus Act that's just been passed, Martin. We're going to be hearing from the former GCHQ whistleblower Catherine Gunn about that in a minute. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, this has been an ongoing debate since the beginning of the crisis, hasn't it? what measures should be adopted, what do people think is a reasonable thing to do, and what people don't agree with. And it's, you know, it's still ongoing.
Well, let's have a listen to Catherine Gunn now then, because I spoke to her again this week. It could even turn into a regular thing, this, I think. And she's absolutely adamant about various things here. Looking at the Canadians who have decided there was no pandemic. Some Canadian doctors have put together a report, which of course has not been covered by mainstream media at all, not even in Canada where they were. So the reasons for that she gives. She's also talking about the Coronavirus Act we've just heard pass there and what it actually says in the Coronavirus Act, and then looking in detail at what it does and why it's so hypocritical and Orwellian. And finally, she's looking at her own analysis that she's done of vaccine injury. So thank God we've got someone from the Secret Services, GCHQ, who was doing analysis for the government, now doing analysis for us.
I'm Catherine Gunn, and I worked at GCHQ as a Mandarin linguist and analyst in 2001 to 2003, and I blew the whistle on the NSA memo that was basically asking for GCHQ's help to spy on UN Security Council delegates in order to be able to influence them on the vote which would authorize the invasion of Iraq. And I leaked that, and I got charged with breaking the Official Secrets Act, and eventually they dropped the charges against me. I saw a very brief clip of the inside of the House of Commons, where a few MPs were gathered by the door and the Speaker of the House was sitting there, and the entire episode, it was only a few minutes, but it was pretty repulsive, really, to watch them cheering and jeering. And they sounded like, and they looked like, when I watched it, a bunch of prefects in a private school gathered in their junior common room, basically chortling over something. I was pretty appalled by that behavior following one of the brutal murders of one of their own so recently. How on earth could they possibly be in such high spirits, cheering and making these kind of jokey, laughing expressions about extending these emergency powers?
Well, there was also the section of where the deputy speaker asked for a vote, where they say the ayes have it, and then they say the noes. I think it was an MP who was actually in the shot, was chanting yes, or shouted yes, in the middle of the noes, obviously drowning out the noes. So that quite clearly is a breach of procedure, where you would have hoped that any decent chair would have called for a revote of some sort. I think this is where, Catherine, what they do is they just have a kind of shout, you know, a bit like when the unions all stick their hands up, and you can get a general opinion of what's going on in the meeting through just the sheer number of people. And then they may have a formal vote if it's obvious that it's finally split. But anyway, you know, the idea that you can just shout over the opposition, I thought was incredible, and you know, there should have been some sort of acknowledgement that the MP that was murdered on Friday would have been one of the lead speakers in that debate.
Yes, well, that is also something which has created a sort of concern in me as well. The fact that he was killed so soon before, and it's pretty apparent that Ramos was also somebody who was actually very concerned about the abuse of powers by the Coronavirus Act. There should be a big investigation into his murder, because according to what was revealed in the press and which was covered by UK Column News, they said that an air ambulance crew attended the scene not as rapidly as normal, but it was there within 20 minutes or so. But then they didn't transfer him to hospital within the golden hour. Everybody knows that in traffic accident cases and those sorts of emergency situations where people need to be immediately in hospital for treatment, there is this so-called golden hour where if you don't manage to get any treatment, then your chances dramatically decrease in surviving. And the ambulance crews, they were there on the scene for over 2 hours. What were they doing for 2 hours? Why didn't they immediately transfer him to a hospital? I mean, those sorts of questions need to be asked. You know, we need deep investigations into what actually happened and who this man was that is being accused of doing it and what are his connections. And, you know, he was part of apparently this PREVENT program. He'd been flagged up. So we know that the PREVENT program, Mark Curtis has also in his book, the book about how the state of the UK is actually working hand in glove with extremist groups within the UK and fomenting the extremism and the hate in there in order to achieve what they want, which is, you know, this concept of these terrorist cells within the UK so that they can clamp down. They're giving an excuse for them to continue to have a job for internal security. We need to clamp down on these extremists among us because...
Well, I think, sorry, Catherine, but I think the book you're talking about is Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam.
That's right, yeah. That's the one, yeah.
I think there's something, just if you don't mind me interrupting, that is a little bit similar to the death of Princess Diana, because there was also a lot of comment at the time and afterwards and at the inquest, etc., about the length of time that it took for her to be taken to hospital. And again, it was nearly 2 hours. You would have thought that in that sort of situation, it would have been fairly simple to get a ambulance to the church and get him to hospital rapidly.
Of course. And I think the same, if I'm not mistaken, I think the same occurred in Jo Cox's murder as well. She wasn't rushed to hospital either. So all of these murders raise a hell of a lot of questions.
Well, they're political murders, I think probably more correctly called assassinations, really. I mean, if it's a political murder, it seemed strange to me that suddenly there was a, oh, this is terrorism. The Essex police were very swiftly moved out of the way for Neil Basu, who was the boss of Wayne Cousins, by the way, the murdering policeman. That Essex police are swept out of the way and in come counter-terrorism command.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I think, you know, independent journalists and investigative researchers need to keep their eye on, because there's just so many holes in the narrative, as usual, about these cases.
Okay, well, what about the idea of renewing this Coronavirus Act? Because that seemed to just sort of go through on the nod, as we said at the start. Well, what about the effects of that?
It didn't surprise me that it went through, to be honest, Tony. I mean, there's been no effective parliamentary scrutiny and challenge of these things. It just seems as though they've kind of accepted that it's going to carry on till March 2022, and so be it. I just want to bring up a research paper that was released in August of this year. It's available on ResearchGate. It's by Dennis Rancor, who, as you may know, he's been accused of being a bit of a skeptic, as it were. He and a couple of other individuals researched the Canadian all-cause mortality figures from 2010 to 2021. And their conclusion was that there hasn't even been a pandemic in Canada. And in their actual paper, they quote Peter Doshi, who has stated previously that there are two main points that you have to consider for a viral respiratory infection. And the two key points according to Peter Doshi, is that one, it occurs everywhere, irrespective of state or jurisdictional boundaries, presumably because there is no prior immunity, and two, it causes excess mortality, far greater than that due to non-pandemic seasonal viral respiratory disease epidemics. So those are the two defining characteristics of viral respiratory diseases, VRDs. But they go on to state that one problem in practice is that VRD class mortality is difficult to quantify. The actual number of VRD attributable deaths is always uncertain, especially when the deaths are counted in the context of a media frenzy about, quote, the pandemic. This is as true today as it was when epidemiology was a nascent science, because a cause of death determination with many cofactors and in the absence of an analytical autopsy is prone to human error, human bias, institutional bias, and even constructed bias, as we have seen in the COVID period. So they've concluded, Tony, from their research that Canada did not actually experience a pandemic. What actually happened, and they state this, is that the key notable anomalies of this so-called pandemic was that predominantly the most elderly, people over the age of 85, died from the immediate response to the pandemic, which was announced by the World Health Organization on the 11th of March, 2020. And I think you can see that pattern repeated across many of the centers of mortality. So we saw that initial spike in mortality in New York City. We saw it in the UK. We saw it in the north of Italy, in Belgium, and so on. I think those were the main areas where there was a sort of in the March-April period, a lot of very elderly deaths, you know, deaths in those who are over the age of 80 and who had comorbidities and who in the main were either in hospital or in care homes.
Hang on, because what you're saying there is that actually it was the institutions charged with looking after our health that led to so many people dying.
Yeah, so in their research article, they go into the fact that the deaths were caused by the response. It was the government responses to this announcement that there was a public health emergency by the WHO. It was that response by governments which led to the deaths of these elderly people. And in the UK now, we have a number of individuals who have been sending out copious amounts of freedom of information requests since at least August, if not sooner, last year, to all kinds of authorities within the UK. First of all, there is a chap who's done a lot of this, a guy by the name of Mark Oakford, who sent out over 1,000 freedom of information requests last year to all the civil service sectors in the UK, asking how many of the staff working for them died as a result of COVID. And, you know, that information came out in alternative media. Of course, it was never broadcast on any of the old mainstream media channels, but the mortality rates were far, far lower than anything that was being discussed in the mainstream. So, you know, based on millions of staff and the results from his collating the data, over 684 replies he got from his over 1,000 requests, the mortality rate was something like 0.0077.
Yeah, but hang on, because most of those people, of course, were, well, all of them pretty much, will be below retirement age and therefore not people who are most vulnerable to COVID.
Right. But I think you could argue that in that, the numbers of people covered by the civil service are vast, right? People who are employed and he sent it out to Wales, Scotland, and England. So he got all the different areas, and you know, you have sort of a mix of age groups between ages of, you know, 18 and let's say 65 retirement age, and huge ranges in ethnicity and in as well overall health, including the police, including the ambulance. The numbers of people who passed away in those age groups are, like I say, that it was 0.007.
Well, I suppose the point you could make is that all these people have been persuaded to have vaccines where actually it doesn't look as if they were vulnerable.
Well, indeed. Yes. And then, of course, there will be a lot more research now to compare from last year to this year and how their health, you know, and I think the outcomes are not good. I mean, they've already come out with research that's looking like for the younger, much younger cohorts, already it's showing that children between the ages of 16 and 25 or perhaps even younger, the incidence of heart and bad health outcomes, the mortality is 25% higher already. So it's looking like what I'm trying to say is that because they changed the definition of pandemic fundamentally back in 2010, taking away the actual
definition. So when you say they, who do you mean? The British UN, the WHO?
The WHO. I don't know if many people are aware of this. It's been repeated many times in alternative investigative media. But back in 2010, the World Health Organization removed key characteristics of a pandemic definition by saying only has to be a disease, a new disease, that spreads widely across many countries. And they removed the fact that it had to cause a lot of serious illness and great numbers of death. They removed those two things. So it doesn't have to cause serious illness, doesn't have to cause a lot of death. It just has to spread widely and be a novel disease. Now, that's basically what happened. We had as Wolfgang Wodarg, the doctor and politician who exposed the swine flu pandemic back in 2009 and 2010, what happened back then is what is happening now, except fourfold, tenfold. It's on a much grander scale, and he's been repeating the same thing that he said back in 2010. Now, you know, it just appalls him. There's a new interview with him on the Planet Lockdown podcast. So that's just gone out recently, where he's talking about all of these things. So this brings us back. So if we consider the possibility that actually there has been no pandemic, there's been no massive increases in all-cause mortality, and I think that has been proven. Last year, there were no massive increases in all-cause mortality. So then what is the point of these emergency measures? These emergency measures of Coronavirus Act, which they passed in March last year, were implemented, I'm looking at the actual renewal of temporary provisions document. It says they were implemented to enable the government to respond to an emergency situation and manage the effects of the pandemic. The Act aims to support government in doing the following. Now, these are the five key areas that the government claims the Coronavirus Act allows them to protect the population and to support them. So, firstly, number one, increasing the available health and social care workforce. Well, I think what we found was, as people within the healthcare industries and in the nursing homes were forced to take those PCR tests and rapid antigen tests from the beginning for the last 18 months, that has had a serious impact on workforce numbers in both the nursing homes, care homes, and in the hospital sector. So that's just one aspect of it, the pingdemic, you know, the testdemic. So they've actually done the opposite of what they started out, what they claimed the Act would allow them to do. Number two, easing the burden on frontline staff. So obviously that goes back to the first point. A burden on frontline staff has been increased, not eased, by this testemic and this pandemic, and now by vaccine injury. Number three, containing and slowing the virus. There's no factual basis to this statement at all. As the previous point about the viral respiratory diseases, it's impossible to contain a viral respiratory disease. Any virologist, immunologist, and scientist will tell you that. They all know this. You cannot contain a viral respiratory disease. So that's nonsense.
No, but you can slow it down, can't you, with a lockdown? You can slow down the spread because people are mingling less.
No, it didn't work. It didn't slow anything down. As I said last week, the studies that have gone into the non-pharmaceutical interventions, so the public health measures that they implemented of lockdown, of restrictions, of quarantines, of curfews, and so on, they had no impact on the spread of the virus. Number four, managing the deceased with respect and dignity. That almost makes me want to vomit, because the number of people who've had the most heartbreaking experiences in the last 18 months of not being able to see, never mind see the deceased, they haven't been able to see their elderly relatives and their loved ones, either in care homes or in the hospital, and they're FaceTiming them in their hour of need and FaceTiming people during funerals and so on. It's been an absolute humanitarian, it's been a hugely traumatic experience.
Alison Pollock, she's a professor or doctor or whatever, but she's a health analyst from Newcastle University, called it barbaric.
It is. It has been barbaric. So again, this fourth point, which the government says that the Coronavirus Act enables them to do, it's sort of Orwellian. It's doing the opposite of what they state in this document. And finally, the fifth one, supporting people. And I suppose the support refers to the financial aid. But they're starting to wind up, you know, they're rolling back that support now. So it seems to me that there is no basis, in fact, for any of their claims. And in fact, most of what they state is the opposite.
I'd add to that, when they say supporting, actually what's happened is tens of thousands of small and medium businesses have had to fold up simply because they couldn't either navigate the bureaucracy of the furlough scheme or support schemes. And totally the opposite is the case for these massive transnational corporations who have quadrupled it and even more their share prices and their market shares.
Right. I mean, small businesses who maybe depend on, in these little Cotswold villages and in Scotland, in the Lake Districts, and all these tiny little places that depend on tourism, for instance, they can't suddenly put all their stuff online and start selling all their trinkets and all their tea towels online, no. And the same goes for the catering, the service industry, in terms of cafes and tea shops and all the rest of it. It's an absolute catastrophe. It's Orwellian, because everything that the MPs and the talking heads and the Prime Minister states is just sort of Orwellian doublespeak now, it seems to me.
To go back to this repassing the 6-monthly review of the Coronavirus Act, yes, there was a short debate, but it went through without a vote, just a few people shouting over each other, saying no and yes, and that seemed to be enough for the deputy speaker. But immediately we're hearing bring back COVID rules as cases rise, say NHS chiefs. But the business secretary is saying it's not time for Plan B, which is kind of looming like a sword of Damocles over us. Well, he doesn't say that, I do. And he wants to avoid further lockdowns. So he's saying that we're still on the edge of another lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, it's a psychological war. It's a form of torture, being in a constant state of limbo, Tony. This unrelated, but I kind of experienced this when between the periods of having been arrested in March 2003 and being charged with being arrested on suspicion of breaking the Official Secrets Act, and then not being charged for 8 months until November 2003, that not knowing whether I was going to be charged or not, although I didn't feel it at the time, it was hugely traumatic. And I think that's what caused a sense of PTSD afterwards, which I never really went into myself. I just let time sort of ease that shock and experience. This is far greater than that. This sense of limbo has extended now for nearly 2 years. And people cannot live comfortably and without stress when they can't plan, when they can't know for sure that this Christmas they'll be able to spend it with their family. Everything is always up in the air, and it has been since this started. And that is a form of mental torture. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, all of this that they're claiming to do is to protect people against some invisible virus. It's all psychological manipulation, and the rising cases, I think we'll find that, and it's already been pointed out in some, again, alternative media, that the data put out by Office of National Statistics shows that the people who have been vaccinated, either once or twice, or now, even a third time, are much more likely to test positive. They're more likely to test positive, and they're more likely to be hospitalized. Now, it's come out in the mainstream media that, you know, it's the unvaccinated who are filling up the hospitals. They don't ever give you any data for that, though. They don't give you any actual proof of that when they make these announcements. You know, the fact that by their definition, a person who is unvaccinated, it doesn't mean that they have not been jabbed. A person who is unvaccinated to them is someone who has only received one jab of a two-jab vaccine, and or they are within 2 weeks of the first or second jab. So basically, they can play with the definitions of who is unvaccinated. The people ending up in hospital 1 week after the jab are basically counted as unvaccinated. So this will skew their figures, right, hugely. And in Australia, coming out in Australia when they make their announcements about how many people have died, supposedly from COVID, it's always 8 out of 10, or sometimes even 10 out of 10, who have been vaccinated. There is a document on the Office of National Statistics website which states how many people have died within 21 days of the first dose, how many have died after 21 days of the first dose, and so on, how many died within 21 days of the second dose, and so on. I suppose you could argue that, well, you can't determine what caused the death of those people if they died within 21 days or even more so after 21 days. But isn't that how they count people who've died from COVID? They count people who've died within 28 days of a positive test. Is that right?
No, in fact, originally, it was if they'd ever had a positive test.
Within 60 days or, you know, as you say, whenever they had a test. So if we wanted to compare like with like and say, okay, this is how we define a person who's died from COVID, then let's also apply that to people who've died following a COVID vaccination. So that, you know, that's what I basically did, and I totted it all up. And this is only from January to beginning of July of this year. The total was 162,000 plus. And why aren't they releasing those sorts of figures? Why don't they say that 30,000 people have died in the past 6 months following the first dose of the vaccine. Why don't they say things like that?
Well, yes, good question. I mean, what she's doing there, Martin, that's Catherine Gunn, former GCHQ whistleblower, doing a little bit of analysis of her own for us, saying that they're applying a point that she's making at the end, completely different criteria as to whether people have died of COVID or whether they've died of the vaccine.
Well, it may be that the vaccines don't work, Tony.
Well, maybe that they're. I mean, why do you think they're doing that? You know, so they're saying, well, if you've died within 28 days of a vaccine, it doesn't matter. But if you've died within 28 days of a positive COVID test, which may be negative, it may be a false positive, then it does matter.
Well, the point I'm making is the implication of that is that the vaccines don't work, which means that we're back to lockdowns.
So are you fully vaccinated? Because this is the question, isn't it?
I'm up to date for my age group.
Have you had your booster?
No, because they're not but my age, I've got to wait till November sometime, in theory, to get the booster.
Do you feel a bit cheated when you were told you had to have two jabs and now you're being told you've got to keep going?
Well, I mean, the implication is coronaviruses are like flu viruses and cold viruses, and we've never been able to develop an effective vaccine against colds and flu. So it may well be that all this stuff about vaccines is irrelevant. It doesn't really work, and that in actual fact the only measures we have got are what you might call administrative measures, that is to say effective lockdowns, e.g. what happened in China.
Lockdowns, she's saying, don't work.
That's a different question from the vaccines, isn't it? Let's separate these two things out.
Do you want to just react to, because you were scribbling away through there.
Well, I've got anything.
Yeah, go for it. Go on.
The first point about Joe Cox being murdered, and there was questions about whether that was the deep state. It could be the case. I mean, in Gladio in the 70s and 80s, politicians of both, you know, left and right were being murdered in order to create an atmosphere of chaos. Okay.
The strategy
of defense.
Yeah, that seems to be what we're going through now.
Okay, so then the question is about what is and what is not a pandemic, and of course if they change the definition, then obviously that changes things. Now the point I would make about various places in Europe, in Iran, they had a massive outbreak, mostly of their top leadership, which is why they are very suspicious about all of this. They didn't get it, coming in through a port or anything like that where they could say, well, and it was also a different variant from the one in Wuhan. So they immediately, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the guy who replaced Soleimani, said, we think this is a biological warfare attack on us. So they immediately interpreted it in the light of the assassination of Soleimani earlier in the year, in the January. Now, the government failure in Canada or whatever, I don't really know the details about what happened in Canada. But I mean, it's quite clear that the government in this country initially resisted lockdowns, resisted taking any measures whatsoever. So that, you know, and in different countries there have been different responses. So she didn't really pick up on that. Russia this week has gone into a lockdown because they're having the worst time they've had through the whole crisis, even though they've got their own vaccines.
That these lockdowns haven't been working. If the Russians the
Chinese one has worked. The Russian one hasn't, because they've got a very similar social structure to ours, where everybody does what the hell they like.
And isn't it actually just coming to, I mean, particularly in Russia, obviously, it's coming to that time of year again. It's the flu season.
Yes, it is. But I'm just pointing out that if it's big pharma in the West that are behind all of this, the Russians are having a lockdown anyway. As Putin pointed out at the Valdai Club, he spoke at the Valdai Club yesterday, but last year he said, if you think that we are working with the West to push vaccines, you're deluded. We're nearly at war with them. So it's definitely not about that. So that's the point I'd make about that.
Just go back to that, because I mean, Russia, it's very interesting, I think, that Russia is the first to have gone into. I mean, they say it's the third wave, the second wave. Surely it's just another flu season coming on, or a respiratory season.
You better have that out with the Russian leadership.
But isn't it a respiratory disease season coming along? And it just so happens we've got this COVID circulating now, which is a bit nastier than
Russians,
usual.
The Russians are very resistant to the idea of having a lockdown. They're having one because they've not been able to control what they're doing. The Chinese have got some lockdowns in limited areas because they have actually had a much more effective COVID war, and it is a war, and I'll come to that in a minute, than the Russians have had. They've actually done rather badly. Right, so I've made the point that in actual fact what's happened in this country has been stubborn resistance to carrying out effective measures against COVID, like Eat Out to Help Out last year, has clearly been a disastrous policy. It costs millions of pounds and actually spread COVID.
Well, Martin,
COVID.
Yeah, you sent me that article on email during the week, and I sent you one back saying completely the opposite.
That oh, no, I'm not
that's definitely
that.
Disputed, that oh, no. whether Eat Out to Help Out actually made any difference at all.
Well, the point I would make is that they then had to lock down subsequently, so it implies that they got it wrong. They themselves admitted that by locking down. Okay, let's move on.
Well, Sir David Amos was very outspoken against that.
Yes, indeed.
And
if he'd led the debate in the House of Commons, he would have lost, because the majority of MPs don't agree with him. She's gone about, you can't contain viral infections. Well, the Chinese have done it. They've got 1 billion people. They did it.
Well,
they did.
I mean, I would also make the point that the New Zealanders seem to have almost done it.
Yes.
Because they're an island, but also because...
No, the Chinese are not an island. They did
no,
it.
No, no, no.
Far more
I'm
important.
Just talking about New Zealand for a second, Martin, if you'll let me finish the sentence, is that the New Zealanders managed to contain it because they were way ahead of us in terms of where the virus was spreading. And so they were able to say, well, we're an island. In fact... Imagine it, say, if COVID had broken out in New Zealand.
It broke out in Wuhan, apparently.
Let's just listen a second, right? Listen, you have to let me finish my points, yeah, rather than interrupt in the middle of them. If the virus had started in New Zealand and started spreading around that part of the world, it certainly would have been feasible for the British to close their border, you know, for us to close our borders around the UK, and we could have probably stopped it getting in if we wanted to. But I think her point she's making very well is that this is only very much a temporary measure. At some point, it's going to get in.
It is, but of course, pointing out New Zealand, the real significance here is China was the supposed source of the outbreak, although there is some dispute about that.
Well, there's a lot, especially on this show.
Yeah, okay, but the point I'm making is that they did, and to say you can't stop it, they did stop it, okay? They treated it as a biological warfare attack. And succeeded.
And then a couple of months ago, it came back again.
Well, of course. And of course, they've got their own vaccine program. And this is what's happening in New Zealand is because they don't want to keep the borders locked forever. They're now trying to vaccinate everybody so they can open up.
Maybe we could agree that lockdowns can delay it, but I don't think you can ever stop it.
Well, in theory, what stops it, according to the official story, is vaccines. But we've already questioned whether vaccines do that. Now, when she says it's barbaric, everything to do with this...
Well, I said that.
Well, yeah, but the point is, I agree with that. Everything to do with this has been barbaric, because I think this is a biological warfare attack on China. Ron Unz of the Unz Report agrees with me, and of course I'll come back to the fundamental smoking gun in all of this, is that the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States of America, an equivalent to GCHQ, warned the Israelis in November last year, no, 2 years ago now, isn't it, that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. That implies they had foreknowledge of the pandemic.
Well, I don't think the DIA is an equivalent to GCHQ, okay. Is it? The NSA is, but well, it's similar to, Army Intelligence.
They've got loads of different, you know, there's loads of different organisations, but the point I'm making is that foreknowledge implies that they knew what was going to happen.
Which does.
Okay.
Yeah. And the Israelis, yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, you didn't ask Catherine Gunn about the biological warfare aspects of this, which maybe you should have done as a journalist.
Well, Martin, I did, but all I'll say is that, you know, we had 25 minutes there,
okay.
And you can't fit everything in.
Right.
I just remind listeners that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, what Martin's just referred to and all sorts of other aspects, and we'll be hearing another shorter clip from her in a minute about Assange, but there's a longer interview going up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later this evening.
Okay, well, let's pick up on this furlough thing. Furlough, in fact, rescued, you know, it was completely against Tory philosophy to pay 80% of everybody's wages, but they had to do it, so they did it. The problem is now they're withdrawing it when they shouldn't withdraw it, and it's actually kept lots of small businesses afloat which would otherwise die. So, in actual fact, they should carry on, in my view, spending money to keep businesses afloat. And in actual fact, probably, we're going to have to socialise the whole economy at the end of this process. So, in actual fact, private enterprise is probably finished as a concept. That is actually what's going on. Adam Tooze, who's he's an economic historian, has just written a book about all of the whole crisis and pointed out that what it's done is completely changed, blown the whole free market philosophy out of the water.
So by bailing out the banks and by bailing out everybody in the COVID thing, The world is going socialist, really, in a way. Yeah. This is welfare for the super rich.
Yes, well, it's welfare for the super rich, but that implies that we should have welfare for everybody. And of course, the real welfare.
Well, I wonder if any of that's going to trickle down, Martin.
Well, indeed. In China, they're going to make sure it does. Their evergreen has just collapsed, or is in the process of collapsing, but the Chinese Communist Party are going to let it collapse, and they're going to let it flow through the system and wipe out various billionaires. But their economy won't collapse because they've got the resources to allow that to happen.
They're in control of their own infrastructure. That's right.
And including the banks.
Unlike us.
That's right. So of course, you can see where all this is going, because this we're talking about warfare here. Okay, so let's come on. What do I also write? Well, this all Orwellian thing about tea shops being and Christmas being, I mean, this is
what she's calling Orwellian is she's going through the main aims of this coronavirus act and saying, well, actually, for example, in terms of, you know, just one of the points was about dignity. It's done the total opposite.
Yes. Okay. But if it's a biological warfare attack, the whole world is at war, Tony. Lots of people have died. Millions have died already and millions more are going to die. Don't forget the 9/11 attack was carried out from inside the US security forces, which has led to millions of deaths in Syria, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan.
So what is this? Asymmetric? Hybrid?
What we're dealing with is World War III, which is horrible in a completely different way from World War II, which was horrible in a completely different way from World War I. That's the way it works.
And each time is it bigger?
Each time it's bigger and worse.
It really is a World War.
Yeah.
The
kind of spectrum of weaponry used is massively increased. Yeah. In the First World War, it was just it wasn't even tanks, it was just artillery.
Well, we've got cyber war, we've got space war, we've got psychological war, we've got economic war, but I suppose they were also economic, certainly, in the Second World War. But anyway, carry on.
Yeah, anyway, so this is a shock doctrine. I mean, I've got common ground with her and you about this. This is a shock doctrine by the, what you might call the feudal elite in the West to try and dominate the world economy. But the problem is that they didn't manage to knock China out at the beginning of the battle, and that's ultimately going to be their undoing.
Well, you call it the feudal elite. I will mention the Bilderbergers.
We can call it whatever we
like. There's now 75 is the list of Bilderbergers.
They are the enemies of humanity.
The people are in the driving seat behind Big Pharma and implementing those global policies. And Robin from Wikispook sent me a terrific tiny little email this week. But isn't this interesting, he said? This guy who was a war criminal at the Nuremberg trials actually popped up at a Bilderberg conference. He was supposed to have died, but then he popped up at a Bilderberg conference in 1961 and 1962. Yeah. So, you know, there's quite obviously a massive Nazi influence in the Bilderbergs.
Indeed. Yeah, but there's not much of a Nazi influence in the Chinese Communist Party, not least because it's China and they didn't have one. I've pretty much rattled through everything I wanted to say.
In the West there, you were talking about this as a Western operation, really. I would suggest a kind of a Fourth Reich is implementing itself.
Yes, I mean, it's the remnants of what was the Fourth Reich cooperating with the Anglo-Zionists.
It's been a very powerful, as we've looked into in the past, it's a very powerful financial corporate empire that's with transnational aims. I suppose you could call it a fascist international.
All right. Anyway, let's just bring it down to a more prosaic level. The British Medical Association this week basically nailed their colours to the mast and said the government have taken their eye off the ball. That is doctors. Lots of them.
Okay, well, anyway, let's have a listen now, because Catherine mentioned this interview on the Pandemic podcast there with a guy called, who has hardly been heard from at all. I think maybe we can call him Doctor of the Week. Wolfgang Voldar. Wolfgang Wodarg. Now, he was instrumental in the last 15 years of actually pointing out that vaccination programs for the swine flu were wrong, and he managed to get the vaccination programs halted, and he explains now what his experience was that's led now from the bird flu and swine flu pandemics of what's going on now. So let's have a listen now to the it was, I believe, in July. This is the Pandemic podcast. Dan Astin Gregory, I think, does that. And again, this is another one. I'm going to put up the full version on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Dr. Wolfgang Voldarg.
For me, it started in 2005 with the bird flu. It was the first time I was in Parliament, and I heard that our government wanted to buy the Tamiflu tablets against the flu. It was the bird's flu which was announced then to come all over the world, and with the flying birds. And they put nets over the meadows where the goose leave, where the goose were running. So they made really fear that we could be infected by some virus coming from birds. And I could not imagine how this could happen, because the viruses are specialized. And how do they know that the virus was just jumping in time to human beings? So I traveled to the WHO. And to meet Mr. Stöhr, he was the head of this department there in WHO for pandemics. And I interviewed him. I asked him, Mr. Stöhr, please tell me the evidence. Why do you make such a fear to people? He spoke about some million deaths that could happen. And he just gave me a CD, and I took it home, and it was a CD which was advertising Tamiflu. And he could not give me any evidence how this virus could jump from birds to human beings. There was no parallel. It was just some virological theory, and it was very poor what he could offer. So I was warning at home. I went home, so don't buy this stuff. And it's a tablet which has side effects too. There were side effects reported from Japan, from children psychologically disturbed by this drug. And so I said, no, we don't need it. It doesn't help. And afterwards we found out with other scientists, Tom Jefferson and Peter Doshi from British Medical Journal, we found out that Roche didn't publish all the results they had about Tamiflu, but they kept it as a secret for many years, and they had to go to court to get it, and they had to make pressure to get all the information. And in the end, they found out Tamiflu had more negative than positive effects. So this was the first experience. And knowing this, I heard about Mexico in 2009. I heard about Mexico, and I heard about some 600 and so cases. And Neil Ferguson was the one who presented this with his big graphics and with big PowerPoint pictures. He presented it to the WHO, to the experts there. And I got his publication then, and I was very astonished, because I saw there were only some less than 1,000 cases, 600 and something, in April it was, 2009. And I was thinking of my own experience in the region where I was a director of a public health institution. I was in charge of watching the flu seasons, so I knew when there is a flu season. There are about 3% of the population, if it's a heavy flu season, is ill. Each week, 3% is touched by this flu and gets some with fever, without fever, more severe, less severe, and that doesn't go to work. So I made a sentinel myself. And in my region, it was Mrs. Thompson. She was working in my office. And I asked each Monday to take a phone and to make a phone call to always the same doctors, the same to the clinics, to the employers, to the military sanitary service, and to some big offices, and always asking the same questions. What about flu cases? What about the typical symptoms of flu? Has it become this week less or more, or what do you think? And so she gave me, within 3 or 4 hours, she gave me the results of her questioning those institutions. And I always knew there is something coming, or no, there's nothing coming. I had a very good, and this was a region of 150,000 inhabitants. And when the flu season came, there were 10,000 people ill. So right. When I heard about 600 cases in Mexico, and seeing all those funny pictures, I looked at had a closer look, and I saw that they just multiplicated those 600 cases with all those aeroplanes going all over the world, and with the possibilities, the passenger of those airplanes could spread the disease from Mexico. It was a calculation game, what they did. It had nothing to do with reality, nothing to do with illness, nothing to do with viruses. So this, I observed this and said, this is a nonsense. And I started speaking about it and publishing about it and said, it's a false alarm. Mm. Be careful. And when I heard then that they were preparing vaccines against it, I found out that since 2005 or even before, they had this plan. And there was this pandemic preparedness. It was running already for several years. This pandemic preparedness was always involving some vaccination schemes. And the governments all over the world, it were more than 100 governments that made contracts with firms producing since this vaccines. And those about 100 countries, the contracts were secret. They were not published. And I got two contracts of it. I got from whistleblowers, one from France and one from Germany. And there was a similar. And the both contracts said that those contracts, that they were in power, that they were valid in case WHO would say it's level number 6 of the pandemic. And this was a plan, a pandemic alertness plan. And so I observed this, and I saw there were some mock-up vaccines already prepared. This was Glaxo, and this was Novartis, and I think there were some other firms who did it too. But those two I observed very closely because they had contracts in Germany, each of them 25 million doses of vaccines. And when I saw this, I was very cautious because I found out that in those vaccines, they had some boosters. They had booster of the. They want try to boost the immune system, that they need a lower dose of antigen, but making a stronger reaction. So they booster the immune system, and this is a very dangerous thing because then this may lead to immune autoimmune diseases and misreactions of the immune system, as we experienced afterwards with the narcolepsy and all those cases. And the other from Novartis, this was a new production. They were not breeding the virus on eggs, but they were breeding it in bioreactors. In those bioreactors, there were cells growing very fast as tumor cells, very fast. And if you always, when you produce vaccines, you always have some, they're not 100% clean. There are always some rests of the stuff which they are extracted from. And then, so I thought, when there's proteins of those tumor-like cells in the vaccines, they could induce tumor. And to find out whether they do or whether they don't, you need about at least five to six years of testing them. And this was not, and so I said, keep away from those vaccines. And I was successful that time. My alarm led to cancel the Novartis contract. And but Glaxo was happy because they were the only ones who sold then. This was not cancelled, but the German doctors were alerted, and because as an example in Sweden, Sweden has much less inhabitants than Germany, so they had about 4 million vaccinations, and Germany too, only 4 million vaccinations. And although we are 8 times more or 9 times more people in Germany. And the doctors were cautious, and the doctors didn't give those vaccines. Now it is different. They have learned from this period, from the swine flu, and they tried to bypass the doctors. They make big stations for vaccines. They employ doctors who don't have their own patients, who just have free time. They just employ some doctors. And they pay them very well. In Germany, they get 170 euros an hour in those vaccine centers. So it's almost like bribing a doctor to help them with this evil method to spread their vaccines. And they had enough doctors to do it. And like this, they bypassed the whole thing, and they could do it in a way. We see it now.
So that's Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg, W-O-D-A-R-G, a clip of the longer interview on the Pandemic podcast with him, Martin. Well, what he's saying is that basically the pharmaceutical industry tried to have a massive market increase back in the 2009 swine flu outbreak, and he said, well, actually these vaccines are simply not safe. Back in those days, they actually ground the whole thing to a halt because of what he'd said. Nowadays, what he's explaining there is that the pharmaceutical industry learned from that experience, and they've now gone round the system.
Yeah, the Western pharmaceutical industry is what it is, but of course it's not just the Western pharmaceutical industry which is dealing with this crisis, whatever it is. You've also got the Cubans, who are not, you know, they've developed four independent vaccines, which have nothing to do with Western pharmaceutical industry.
Are they traditional types of vaccines?
They are traditional types of vaccines.
And do they work? That's
well, I don't know. I mean, the issue is that maybe none of them work. And there are two issues here. Maybe the vaccines are pointless, and that in actual fact we're spending a load of money
on expensive
stuff.
Yeah.
Expensive stuff. Or it may be that they're dangerous, which is another step again. And, of course, what's happened, as he points out, is that because of the crisis, and we've got to open the economy as quickly as possible, they've rushed through this vaccine program, not doing what you would normally expect to do with vaccines. So all of which is fair comment and to the point. But, of course, what happened previously, where Big Pharma is pushing things like, you know, they use an outbreak in Mexico to try and spread it all over the world and try and get people to buy vaccines. This is a bit different. This begins in China, outside the purview and control of the Western powers. And therefore, it's quite interesting that both China, Russia, and Iran, we mentioned earlier, they are hostile to the Western powers, and they certainly wouldn't be helping with such a program. And in fact, they've not helped with such a program because they've adopted their own measures.
Well, surely, I mean, much of this has been steered by the World Health Organization.
Yeah, but the World Health Organization is a bit of a, you know, it's basically like the United Nations. It's what it's made up of its members. And the Chinese have had quite a big of influence in the World Health Organization. But
who funds it? Come on.
No, it was funded mainly by the US. But the Chinese had a big say in it, and that even though they didn't fund it.
And Melinda Gates Foundation.
That's indeed right. But they don't run the Chinese Communist Party or the Cuban Communist Party.
But they do run the WHO.
They run the WHO more than ever now.
Terrific influence
WHO. They do. They do indeed. And all of this is true, and I can buy into all of this, but people are still missing the point. They always see it from their own worm's eye point of view in the West. In the actual fact, half of humanity doesn't live under the control of the West, and they don't operate by the same principles at all. And of course, what the Chinese believe, and I think they haven't, the more they're accused of starting this crisis, the more they're going to come out with this, is that you did this to us deliberately. It's not Big Pharma profiteering on the back of it, but what we're dealing with is a deliberately engineered virus, which is not designed to kill loads and loads of people. It's designed to wreck your economy.
So if the WHO is like the UN, how come the WHO back in 2010 changed this whole definition of a pandemic so that it didn't have to be particularly
suspicious,
have a high mortality rate, and also
that's suspicious.
It has to be something that's all over the world, but I mean it's definitely been changed, that definition.
Yes.
Very interesting what Wolfgang was saying there about how all these contracts were secret with the governments around the world by the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes.
He got hold of them. You know, he was actually shown those some of those contracts, and it was quite obvious that everything was ready for this level 6 pandemic, which then was the definition was then changed about what level 6 pandemic
is. So in other words, the implication to the Occam's razor suggests to me that this is a deliberate attack, and the vaccines, the whole thing about vaccines and profiteering off the back of it is a secondary attack on the population. The initial attack is to spread it around in the first place.
Well, there's also that some of the measures that are taken, and Wolfgang Vodarg has a few things to say about, particularly about the whole idea of using fear to control the population, which is very much what we were hearing previously about. In fact, he was saying in the previous clip about Naomi Klein and masks.
You know, there is not only the virus that we were looking for in the PCR test. There were lockdowns and there were many measures taken to protect us. And what happened there, all those effects, those side effects, it has never been proven with evidence that something like that helps. Mm. You know, I was looking for masks, the effect of masks. I was looking for distance, keeping distant. I was looking for all those measures of keeping people apart and leaving them at home and so on. And I'm a specialist not only for lung diseases, I also have a specialization on hygiene, and I was working in hospitals as a specialist for hygiene. So I know something about what is protecting people and what is not protecting. I myself worked in a special hospital for 2 years for tuberculosis, so I examined many people who were very infectious and with dangerous bacteria. And so, you know, I know about masks and about the use of masks. There's lots of literature before 2020. And all the, if you have a look on the literature on the effectivity, on the effectiveness of masks, you see that the masks don't bring any use when it's about such respiratory viruses. They try to find out with influenza, which has a similar size and a similar way to spread as coronaviruses have. And they didn't find that they didn't find any use for those masks. There was some theory that if you have a very humid speech, that you may protect some people, but it's not even clear whether those viruses come with the big drops or with a small fog you breathe on. It is the best thing you can do is you have one population with 100,000 people. They try to protect themselves in mask, and you have in the same season, and you have the neighboring town, and they don't. And the only exercise I saw was in Denmark. They tried something like that in the beginning of 2020, and they didn't find any significant difference between those who wore a mask and those who did not. And all the other scientific results on the effective on the effect of masks, they were negative. Masks don't protect, but they are dangerous because you have a higher carbon dioxide concentration when you breathe. So for children, they are really damaging children then, and old people with COPD and all asthma and all those people having difficulties to breathe. So there is no indication for masks. But in the beginning of 2020, so from February, suddenly, there were lots of studies on the effect of masks. And suddenly, starting from that time, they have positive results. They said, yes, maybe they have some effect. Yes, maybe they take away the droplets, and this is a good thing. And so, they made some experimental studies. They didn't make so many epidemiological studies because this needs time. The only really good one I saw is this Danish study there. But the others, they were bad studies, and many of them had positive results in favor to wear a mask. You know how this comes, because who pays the study, he can decide what is published and what is not. And it's just we have a corrupt science. This is very clear. We have an institutional corruption in science. This is long lasting already. And we have all those scientific approaches where we try to find out how corrupt is science and medicine. I was in the last 10 years, I was leader of the working group in Transparency International, working group on health, trying to find out corruption in the health system, and I was intensively working there. And I had many struggles with the British chapter, who is paid by Glaxo and others, who are corrupt themselves, to my mind. And so I said goodbye to Transparency some month ago, last year. But there, when I was still working there, I had contacts with international people who are doing the same work, and it was clear that there were very good results, where thousands of publications were watched and were reviewed. And they found out whether if you have a sponsor that is a private sponsor who gives money for a certain question to be answered by scientists, there are as double the positive results as if it would be paid by official, by public money. So when the sponsor first can say what to research, which research should be done and which not, he can put the questions. And on the other hand, he can say, no, don't publish this. I don't want this. Because when they give money, they mostly have such a gagging clause in their contracts that they can say, we have to see it first before you publish. And we have a veto right. So there were very, very bad situation in medical science, and I think there are lots of drugs that are prescribed now by doctors where we could know better, where we should know better.
So that is a second of three clips from Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg, a German doctor who was responsible for the shutting down of the vaccines which were being prepared for the swine flu. Amazing, really. I mean, he's given us a deep insight there, particularly because of the fact that he's been given this sort of secret information, or which way, commercially confidential information. But, you know, what he's talking there about, Martin, is some really basic stuff. That is to say, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Almost all of this research is being funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And, of course, they then have a veto on what gets published afterwards and what doesn't. And also the very things that were being looked into are, you know, that they are determined by who is paying the money for it. I can remember, I mean, maybe two or three years ago, if you go back on some of our old shows and you have a look at a lady called Grace Philby, down in Reigate, she put an application in to, I think it was Glaxo, one of the big pharmaceutical companies, saying, I want to look into macrophages because they're being very successful in different parts of the world. And they just said, no, we're not interested, because they are the ones that are in charge of the funding. I mean, I suppose they'll be thinking to themselves, well, there's no point in looking at macrophages because we can't make any money out of them.
Yeah, and I think the critique of the pharmaceutical industry is well made and well understood. But of course, large sections of humanity do not operate with the Western pharmaceutical industry in charge. They develop their own vaccines. The Cubans, for example, are under blockade, have been since 1959. So they've had to develop their own vaccines because nobody else will share them with them. The Iranians have said that they don't want any Western vaccines because they don't trust the West. And they think that the whole thing's a biological warfare attack. So let's just, you know, let's separate out what's going on here. Because a lot of this kind of critique is actually from within the West, and fails to take on board the fact that the West isn't the only part of the planet, and other things happen in other parts of the planet.
And one of the most fascinating things he says in the whole, I mean, it's brilliant, and I will put it up on our show page. Thank you very much, Catherine Gunn, for flagging this up. Brilliant, fascinating doctor here, since the Doctor of the Week, Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg, is that he found it was actually the British chapter of Transparency International that were so problematic when he was looking into the pharmaceutical industry, because obviously there's a lot of corruption involved in that, and Transparency International is supposed to look into it, but it's the London office of Transparency International that were blocking his work.
Well, Transparency International is a highly suspicious organisation. I mean, basically, what they do is they rate countries on how supposedly corrupt they are. So countries like Russia, for example, are high on their list. Saudi Arabia is high on their list. But in actual fact, the Saudi Arabian and Russian oligarchs wash their money in the City of London. And we are regarded in Britain, in Transparency International's league table, as one of the clean countries,
oh, yes,
even
lovely.
Though all the dirty business goes on here. Switzerland is also regarded as a clean country.
I mean, this is the whole world of NGOs. It's all about who pays for them, which foundations fund Transparency International, and who in that organisation the money goes to.
Also, what happens is when a dirty deal is done in Saudi Arabia, that's counted as a dirty deal in Saudi Arabia. But in actual fact, the dirty deal is done in London with Saudi Arabian money.
Effectively, many of these NGOs are counter gangs.
Yes.
They're actually occupying the space that a genuine NGO might occupy.
Well, exactly. I mean, the whole thing about the Panama Papers, the Pandora Papers and so on, this is definitely intelligence-led. In other words, we're now being presented with scare stories about the evil oligarchs of Russia and all the countries we hate. But in actual fact, all that dirty money, virtually all of it, comes through the City of London. London is the money laundering capital of the world.
Okay.
Even when we talk about the Cayman Islands and the Virgin Islands and so on, that money never goes to the Cayman Islands or the Virgin Islands. It all just circulates within the square mile. Okay, that's point number one. I'll just make a quick point number two about masks. I think you can separate out these different things. Masks, lockdowns and vaccines are all three different things that can be discussed in different ways. And he's saying, well, masks don't work. Well, even if they don't work, they may have a function. He's saying, but it's making people fearful and so on. But if you think back to the Vietnam War, one of the things the North Vietnamese did, they were being bombed from the air by the Americans. They dropped more bombs on North Vietnam than were dropped in the whole of World War II. And what they did...
They say the same about Korea, don't they?
Well, that's right. But they exceeded what they did in Korea in Vietnam. And what the Vietnamese government did is they gave everybody a rifle. Now, what they told them to do is when the bombers are flying overhead at 30,000 feet, we want you to go out and blast away at the bombers. In actual fact, totally ineffective, the bullets would never reach 30,000 feet. But the purpose of giving everybody a rifle was to bolster morale. And that is the argument in favour of masks.
And this is what psychological warfare is all about.
Yes,
isn't
but
it?
Warfare. Morale. Warfare is about morale as well. It's not just about bending people's heads. People have died in this pandemic. Well, through vaccines, possibly, through the pandemic itself, millions of people have already died.
One of the things I would say is, I mean, we've had a complete destruction of British satire over the last decade or 15 years or so, with people like Mark Thomas just booted off the airways, Rory Bremner, people like that. Actually, that's quite important. It's a morale booster. And so we're left to looking for humour to Prime Minister Boris Johnson talking about Kermit the Frog in one of his speeches. So it seems as if humour has deliberately been suppressed in order to try and make out that some of our political and business leaders are the really fantastic guys because they're making us laugh.
Well, I mean, Boris Johnson is a case on his own, isn't he, really? I was just hearing earlier that he went to a vaccine centre today where everybody was wearing masks and he was the only one who wasn't. But there you go.
So a final clip with Dr. Wolfgang Vodarg. He was this interview on the pandemic podcast from July was flagged up by Catherine Gunn, former GCHQ whistleblower, and her little report this week. And he was the guy who was responsible for shutting down the vaccination program that was due to run out at the swine flu. Also, Martin, talk about Tamiflu. Tamiflu ended up being something which was more damaging to people than it actually damaged them more than it helped, unlike ivermectin, which is the opposite. And they were both similar things, antiviral drugs to stop the virus replicating. The spending of the governments back then on Tamiflu, I found absolutely staggering. In Britain, we spent nearly £500 million on Tamiflu, virtually none of which was ever used. In the US, it's $1.5 billion was spent on this stuff. It was just going out of its shelf life, apparently, and hardly any of it was used, just a handful of pills. And what pills we now know were actually more damaging to people than good.
Yeah, and we spent, $35 billion on Test and Trace run by Dido Harding.
Oh, so I suppose we look back on, the pharmaceutical industry must look back on that. So, we made quite a lot of money there. Maybe we can try something different next time. Anyway, back to Wolfgang Vodarg, the final clip with him, where he looks at, again, at fear through the PCR tests.
They make us afraid of this result of PCR tests. And this is something which has nothing to do with virology. This has nothing to do with immunology. This is just to do with, it's politics, and it's people try to reach something, making us afraid. And you have to read Naomi Klein when you want to understand it.
Yes,
and about the strategy. how is it called? The fear strategy or shock strategy, if you call it.
The shock doctrine, yes. Yeah, yes. The fear of contagion.
Very often used strategy to deregulate a population. If you have fear, if you succeed to spread fear among people, the democratic, you always have reasons to bypass democratic ways of decision, and you can say, it's an urgent case, we have just to do it. And those people who are at the steering wheel, they misuse this, and there are secondary interests that interfere. And the worst thing is the media. When Glaxo did it with the swine flu, I observed that the son of Mr. Murdoch, he was becoming director for 2 years, just in that time, in the Glaxo board of directors. The son of, one son of Mr. Murdoch, of the media, guy there. And this is how they really prepare such things. And without the media, we would not experience all this. And we, as a society, we are dependent on the media. We are dependent on the media because what we can experience ourselves without media is just in our constituencies, just in our neighborhood, is just in a small region. We can travel a little bit and make ourselves a picture. But this is not sufficient. So we are always dependent on what the media tells us. And the media has to be independent. There is no economic force and no politic force who should interfere. And they do. Both
yes.
do.
Yep.
They did. We all know that in communist times, the Communist Party was telling on the Chinese, they are telling the media what to write now. And it's in, within our, it's in our states is now. It's the same. It's part of it is coming from the economical side. Others come from the political side. Sometimes the journalists are bribed, or the whole, not the single journalist, but the whole media is just bought. You know, the institutional corruption is when you don't have to bribe the single clerk, but if you buy the whole office. So then you don't have to need to, then you don't, there's no need in bribing single ones. You can just kick them off if they don't want to follow. They just can take new ones in the job.
Yes, I mean, we had evidence of that. You might have been referring to James Murdoch. Actually, I've lost the name myself. But we spoke with Laura Dodsworth last night, who's the author of State of Fear. She interviewed a lot of the behavioural scientists, a lot of the people within involved in the UK response, specifically looking at this kind of machine of fear. But she shared that the government basically had a hotline to the media, which would influence what they printed. Not only that, the government spent millions and continues to spend millions on newspaper advertising, billboard advertising. The message is controlled and paid for by the governments and the pharmaceutical companies. This is very evident. This is happening.
Well, there is a very good book about Britain, How Corrupt is Britain, it's called. And it's by some Mr. White or so is the author, and it's an anthology, and there are many chapters on different parts of society, and it's about systemic corruption or institutional corruption, and I think it's a very good one, and you could write similar books to Germany and to other states too.
Okay, well, he's also, Martin, talking about the media there. Fascinating bit of news, isn't it, that Glaxo had James Murdoch, or we're told it was him anyway, on their board just for a couple of years around the time of the swine flu vaccination, which makes sure that the various bits of the Murdoch empire have got the right message for the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is common knowledge that this is, I mean, why are people surprised that the mass media are controlled by the wealthy and powerful and the government is controlled by the wealthy and powerful? It's just obvious that that's going to be the case. And it's been the case for a long time. It's not some new thing. It's been going on for a very long time.
I think, you know, we sometimes, we just expect that the people who are telling us stuff on the media are telling us stuff because they're journalists and they think it's important. It's quite clear that those, no. as he's explaining there, these entire institutions have been bought.
Yes. And that's been going on for a long time. So I totally agree with that, but it's hardly surprising. It's what you'd expect. Let's come back to Naomi Klein and the Shock Doctrine. If you read the Shock Doctrine, She began the book by investigating. She was carrying out a reportage on what had happened after the tsunami, in whenever it was in the noughties around the Pacific, and she went to Sri Lanka and discovered that what had happened as a result of the tsunami was all these traditional fishing communities had been wiped out, and instead of being helped back on their feet, it was regarded as a massive opportunity to take over their land. And to build, you know, luxury hotels and so forth. So she started by picking at that strand and gradually realizing that what went on, when bad things happened, the vulture capitalists battened onto them and then used what had happened in order to transform society in the direction they already wanted it to go in. We wanted to get rid of these people for years. Same thing happened in New Orleans, which is in the book. After the floods of New Orleans, basically the poor people were washed out of the city and they never came back. And it was gentrified. Now, all of this suggests that they opportunistically leap onto things that happen, yeah, in order to then benefit from them. And that is the main thrust of the book. And that's the main weakness of the book as well. Because what she doesn't go on to say, which is probably because, you know, if you want it to be published and you want it to be reviewed and so on, you shouldn't really say these things, is that they deliberately provoke catastrophe. The 9/11 attack, it was a massive wave of fear throughout the Western population. And that was then followed up by various other attacks, 7/7, etc., what we were talking about earlier at Manchester. Now, this is the manipulation of people's fear, but it's not manipulation of people's, just manipulation of people's fear. The actual original attack is carried out by the same people who are manipulating the fear. And that's what I would argue with this pandemic, plandemic, whatever you want to call it. This is a dangerous virus, and it's been deliberately released so that they can create the fear that everybody's going on about. And it's not just that they've battened on to something, they've deliberately engineered it. It's more conspiratorial than even he is suggesting.
But is it being juiced up by the media? Surely this is a media hysteria too.
No, it's a media hysteria too, but the Chinese Communist Party were not part of our media world. They have their own structure.
Oh, they have the free media.
But it's not run by Rupert Murdoch. Okay? Now, the point is that they, who are completely separate from the Western way of doing things, they treated this as a very serious biological warfare attack from the get-go. They basically pressed the button that said, what do we do if we're under biological warfare attack? Because they've been suspecting that something like that may happen for years.
I mean, we hear all about surveillance in China, don't we? But actually, surely the same surveillance is going on over here.
That's right. The Chinese are not doing anything that we're not doing. We try to boast about something. But in our country, we're free. And in China, they're not.
In China, they're doing exactly the same as we're doing. It's more of an overt versus covert. In
China, everybody knows that that's what goes on. And it was before modern technology in China, everybody was grassing everybody else up, and it was all the way they ran things. But it's also to do with the culture in Southeast Asia, which isn't just to do with communism. It's to do with the collectivism, which we don't have. We have a much more individualistic approach to things. And of course, countries with the individualistic approach have actually fared very badly in this warfare compared to those with more collectivist approaches in Southeast Asia.
I mean, for example, in the West, when I was over in Hong Kong talking to the correspondents from the Western press over there at the International Press Club in Hong Kong, they were saying, well, look, yeah, but the Singapore and the Hong Kong governments have a pretty similar attitude in that anybody that becomes a political threat is wiped out either through the courts or financially.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, Singapore is one of the most successful capitalist economies in the world, but it's as somebody once called...
But that involves surveillance, is my point.
Yes, it does. It's Disneyland with death penalties. And the point is that in the developing world, countries like India and other countries are deciding which way to go. And what's beginning to happen is that the model that the Chinese are pursuing seems much more reasonable for them, in Africa, for example, than the Western model, where basically profiteering by the elite is the model. And of course, the Chinese, I've just read a very interesting interview with Michael Hudson. He's written a textbook on super imperialism, which was actually, when he wrote the book in 1972, he then got employed by the Pentagon because they recognized that he's anti-imperialist, but he's employed by the Pentagon to explain to them how it worked. And the book has been upgraded now, Super Imperialism 3, and it's being published in China as a textbook. So in other words, he's got visiting professorships at all these Chinese universities. And the point he's making is the Chinese have a different way of doing things, a more successful way.
One of the things that in the West particularly has been very contentious is this idea of vaccine rollout to children, despite the fact that the government's own agencies have been saying, no, you shouldn't do that. They're doing it anyway. And as we know, that the children are not really susceptible to COVID-19. Of course, they want to try and bring these vaccines into younger and younger and younger children, and multiple, like five or six at a time, even to newborn kids. So, which is potentially very dangerous. It's the sort of thing they were doing back in the 1990s when I was reporting on Gulf War syndrome that the soldiers were so disturbed about, and that many of them were sickened and died as a result of having so many vaccines all at once. And this is healthy soldiers. Now, what on earth, how on earth that translates to kids, God only knows. But anyway, somebody over in the United States is Dr. Rashida Ghauri, and she was speaking recently at the one of the Philadelphia school boards. I think it was in a place called Pensbury, P-E-N-N-S, Pensbury, which is roughly in between Philadelphia and New York, about this whole idea of what is going on to children in their schools. And it's interesting, isn't it, when the people who are running a school, none of whom are medically qualified, actually then get told what to do, and the whole what they're doing explained to them by a medical doctor like her. So let's have a listen to this now from a recent Pennsylvania school board where everyone and anyone from the teachers can come along and talk to the governors of the schools about their policies.
Yeah. It's Dr. Rashida Ghari. Yeah. So it's nice to finally meet you all in person. I'm sure you've enjoyed reading the emails that I've sent to you over the last year. So my name is Dr. Rashida Ghari. I've been practicing medicine for over 20 years. I am a double board certified physician with firsthand experience in the management of COVID-19. I'm also a community member and a mother of three teenage boys. I'm here to help you understand the issues surrounding the masking of our children in our schools. First, a few points for you all to consider. You on the school board have decided that our children should go to school all day, every day, wearing masks like they're some sort of infectious disease spreaders, which they're not. You are supposedly basing this on ridiculous CDC recommendations, which are not at all backed by science. I spent a lot of my time trying to understand your reasoning and must say it's quite angering that you are even discussing the possibility of masking our children again for an entire year. As our elected officials, your reasoning is missing a few things, namely evidence, science, common sense, and basic human decency. So let me educate you all on some of the facts. First, masks and face coverings do not work. They just don't work. They don't work in preventing the spread of any viral illness. This was determined in part from at least three NIH-funded studies that clearly demonstrate that coronavirus and all other respiratory viruses are spread by aerosol particles, which are small enough to go through any mask. Next, COVID is never going away. Do all of you realize that? So pathogens with an animal reservoir cannot be eradicated. Are you planning on recommending masks for our children indefinitely? I'm sure the parents here have a big problem with that if you are. Next, masks absolutely cause harm to our children, including but not limited to increased bacterial and viral infections, hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen, hypercapnia, which is increased CO2 retention, dizziness, headaches, syncope, which is passing out, shortness of breath, anxiety, and brain damage to our younger children. Just to name a few. I could go on, though. Next, even if you all think that masks work, you know that none of the children are wearing the mask properly. You all know that. Next, COVID poses almost no risk to our children at all. Zero. The survivability rate for our children is 99.99%. This is as per CDC numbers. I'm sure you all know that. Next, in addition, you chose to close our schools last year unnecessarily because of, quote, positive test cases, which mean nothing. Do you know why it means nothing? Because these positive cases are based on faulty PCR testing, which by the creator, Dr. Kerry Mullis, of the PCR technology, he stated that that should not be used to diagnose any infection. I don't know if you are aware of that, but that's what it is. So next, what about influenza? The CDC estimated that 480 children died of influenza between 2018 and 2019. That's more than died from COVID in the last year and a half. What? Did anyone on the board at that time recommend masking of our children? Sure. Why not? Sure. Influenza poses more risk than COVID to our children. Next. There has not been a single case of student-to-teacher transmission in the entire world. Let me repeat that. Not a single case of student-to-teacher transmission in the entire world. So when you all are talking about protecting our children and protecting the teachers, it's a lie. Do you know what it's called when you force children to wear a mask for fear of a virus that causes no harm to them? It's called child abuse. Do you have any idea what kind of physical and psychological damage you are doing to our children by forcing them to cover their faces, thinking that the air is toxic and that everyone around them is sick? You all are dehumanizing our children, and you know this. Your job is to protect our children first and to educate them. You are not elected to do anything else. You are not elected to make medical decisions for our children, including masks and including vaccines. You're not elected to do that. None of you are. None of you are doctors. You know nothing about it. In addition, there is no law or regulation that allows any of you to require our children to wear face masks in school. Your motivations are disgusting. Forcing our children to wear masks to make yourselves feel better and to protect yourselves politically. I will not let the school district mask our children any longer.
That is 5 minutes.
It's a symbolic security blanket that has nothing to do with
excuse
the
education
of our
children.
Excuse me, that
is 5 minutes.
Thank you.
So that's Dr. Rashida Ghauri plus a whole load of other parents and probably supporters too there at this Philadelphia, Pensbury, Philadelphia School Board, Martin. I mean, it does seem as if the voices like that have generally not been heard. She's saying that it's a year that she's been emailing them and she's only finally got to actually speak to the people that are running the schools around there in person.
Well, I mean, that is a very strongly political rhetorical speech. And she's obviously...
She would say medical, wouldn't she? Because she's saying that actually the people running the schools are the ones who are politically motivated.
Yeah, but
she's looking at it as a physician.
I'm just listening to it as a speech. There's a lot of political rhetoric there. Whatever you think about
what she's saying was political rhetoric rather than facts about kids and medicine.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a big statement that there has never been any transmission from child to teacher. I would dispute that. I mean, I haven't got a computer in front of me. You've got one in front of you. Maybe you should look it up.
Well,
we've certainly been working in the schools I've been working on the assumption that it can be done and that that's possible. And I bring back to what I said earlier. It's boring of me to mention it, but the British Medical Association that represents British doctors are definitely not of her opinion about all of this stuff. Now, the United States has had one of the worst COVID results in the world. Their death rates have been worse, and that's because there's been no proper organisation at any level of what to do about it, because everything in the US is run on a shambolic basis. Their healthcare system is a joke. They spend far more on it than any other developed country, and they don't achieve any results.
I think she's done quite a good job there, I think, in summarising some of the problems.
Yeah, well, okay,
many parents feel about... They don't feel it's right to be targeting children, making them wear masks, when it's almost impossible for them, unless they've got comorbidity, to even get sick, die of a disease.
One of the doctors you quoted some weeks ago...
These kids are vulnerable, aren't they?
One of the doctors you quoted some weeks ago on this show said that there is no evidence of people having COVID and not having any symptoms. It's symptomless transition. Now, that is not the presumption.
I think that was Mike Yeadon saying
that. Yes, okay, but I mean...
But there's all sorts of opinions out
there.
But there's something sort of a basic kind of almost common sense about why are you making these children wear a mask when they're actually not vulnerable in this disease?
Yeah, because the point is... Just to make the point, is that they can spread it to their grandparents, for example. That's certainly the way in which we've been thinking about it in British schools.
Well, I mean, in the past, didn't we always avoid going to our grandparents if we had the flu or something?
Maybe they're dying in hospital or whatever, and you're not going to be able to go and see them. Okay, so that's another. What I find very strange about the anti-vaccine, anti-lockdown campaign.
Well, she's an anti-mask, actually. That's
anti-mask. About. Well, that's a third. There's three different things there. Is that it's a shotgun. Everything that's going on is just wrong on every level. Now, in actual fact, we should be able to distinguish out these different things.
I think we do.
Trying to do that.
Yes, me
and
too.
What I would also suggest is, if masks are so ineffective, then you just have to stay
home.
But
the point she's making...
Maybe what you need to do is close the schools and they won't have to wear any masks to go to school,
The point that she's making is that inflicting kids with these measures is child abuse. I think that's at the centre of what she's saying.
Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, a reasonably thing to say.
You can say it, but it's an exaggeration.
And isn't it funny how...
We
heard last week that rap, didn't we? Do you remember?
Rap.
It started off with Matt Hancock saying, well, this will never be used on children. This is only an adult vaccine. And now it is being used on children. Anyway, you were about to say something about what goes on in your school.
Well, we've been adopting various measures. Obviously, they've now been rescinded. But everybody in good faith was trying their best not to spread the virus. Now, even if the whole thing is a come-on, which I dispute because I think it's a biological warfare attack, there will be a biological warfare attack further down the line.
Couldn't it be both?
It could be both. It is both. It's a biological warfare attack, and it's an attempt. And of course, what's actually happening by creating this tension around wearing masks and so on, you then create a problem with people not wanting to make that, you know, the vaccines being pushed on people. What's happened in this country is it's quite clear the government at the moment do not want to bring in the measures the British Medical Association think are necessary. They're basically saying they want more people vaccinated. So they're pushing vaccination rather than lockdown as a mechanism for controlling things. And it may well be, Tony, and we could even take a bet on it, because it looks like deja vu all over again. We're doing, we're going to have a lockdown before Christmas in this country,
is
like we did last year.
Because not enough people have had their booster jabs.
That'll be the lot.
Oh dear, another one. Maybe they should have two booster jabs or three. Did you see there was one of the websites, the government websites, has apparently it's got space on it for 8 jabs. So when you sign up saying I'm vaccinated, you can only your COVID pass, which is now apparently much more being used in Scotland and Wales and on the continent, is you're just going to have to keep topping it up every couple of months, have another jab in order to get into your various venues. Anyway, look, Piers Corbyn is one of the big campaigners against this, the brother of Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader, and he was in Gloucester this week talking about, obviously, about the same thing, which is about child vaccinations.
Great here in Gloucester today. Those of you are in cafes wondering what we're doing, we have here a protest against the jabbing of children. This is the most important threat of our time. The government know very well there's no justification for jabbing children. Their own Joint Committee for Vaccination and Immunisation said, don't do it. Don't do it because it will cause some illness and some deaths. But they're going ahead anyway. Why are they going ahead anyway? Well, they have another agenda. They have an agenda of control. They have an agenda of making the population dependent on jabs. There's no need for it whatsoever, I repeat. And we know that in Australia, after thousands of children were jabbed compulsorily, some of them died. Some of them died. It's not the case, it's not true that the jab is going to prevent you getting ill. They themselves admit that. They themselves admit that 60% of people who've officially died from COVID were jabbed already. They were jabbed already. So the jab doesn't work. The jab does not work. And we know in Milton Keynes, the undertaker said that the causes of people getting ill, the causes of people getting ill, they said, has been the jab itself. And indeed, that has caused some deaths. The jab does not work. Sir, this jab, what we have been injected into people, is not a vaccination in the proper sense of the word. It is not, no, it is not a weak virus. It's a medical modification of your RNA. It's an experimental project, which is still officially under experiment. It's under experiment, sir, and you and your children are lab rats. Do you want to be a lab rat? A lot of you know, listening, friends of yours have got seriously ill after the jab. And we know that at least, well, there's figures around, some time ago, it was 1,600 people officially, and the official figures died from the jab. And we now think it is 30,000. That is incredible. That is incredible. Previous jab programs, injections, vaccinations or whatever, such as smallpox, they didn't kill anybody. And when they had trials for vaccines, if anyone died, they pulled the program. They pulled the program if anybody died. After thalidomide, that stuff for pregnant women, remember? After the thalidomide scandal, thalidomide was taken off the market immediately. People have been dying from this jab, but it hasn't been taken off the market. Dr. Michael Yeadon, a former vice president of Pfizer, a man who knows his stuff, says end all the jab programs now. So please, I would say, if you have children and you're discussing in the school whether to take the jab, just say no. Whatever you might think about the ins and outs, it must be safer to wait. Legally, it's an experiment. Don't experiment with your children. Wait 3 years and see what's happened. And by then, I'm sure, either we'll live under a tyranny of fascism, or we will have overthrown these monstrosities, and there won't be any jab programs like this at all.
Hello. I'm from Gloucester. I'm not medical, but I was a nurse, and I've got some good contacts at Gloucester Royal. I'm going to give you a warning now, because you're all going to come across it. Because rugby is a really important thing in Gloucester. There's loads of young males in Gloucester playing rugby in small communities that you all know about. I know of several cases already of myocarditis, which is heart inflammation, and it's irreversible. Young males are susceptible to myocarditis and pericarditis. These are rare illnesses and should not occur very often at all. I have first-hand knowledge from a first person, a staff nurse at Gloucester Royal, that has told me that the cases in myocarditis have spiraled through the roof. Strokes are really up. They cannot cope. This has nothing to do with the hospital not being able to cope with COVID. These are heart problems that are related to the jab, especially in young males. Ask your young males to wait and see what happens over this winter, because they will have people of personal experience of people getting myocarditis, which is irreversible. Thank you.
Okay, so that's Gloucester. Martin, very clear message there. Is a lot of young people seem to be getting damaged by these vaccines.
Okay. First of all, when he was talking, Piers Corbyn mentioned the undertakers, saying what people had died from. Undertakers are not qualified to say what people have died from. So he's, you know, I don't know what they've got to do with anything. He keeps talking about, and so did the other person, talk about the jab. There are a number of different jabs. The Pfizer jab is indeed an experimental.
Well, the point is, surely, most of them are these mRNA vaccines, aren't they?
Well, AstraZeneca has been accused, but the Russians have been accused by the British intelligence services, by the Express and the Sun, of stealing AstraZeneca's material to help produce the Sputnik vaccine.
Well, one thing's for sure, they're all experimental.
No.
Yes, they are.
They're all experimental, but some are vaccines and some are not.
They're all going to be finished their trials in 2023.
Yeah, they're all experimental in that sense. Okay? I agree. The Sinopharm vaccine is experimental in that sense. Okay? But you've got to distinguish between the Pfizer jab, which is the most experimental and the most expensive, and of course it looks as if, unless you make a fuss, your booster jab in this country will be a Pfizer jab. I've got lots of AstraZeneca in my system, but if I go and have a booster jab, it's possibly going to be the Pfizer jab.
I mean, it's like pick and mix.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's even a suggestion that this is better in some way. The lack of discrimination in the way this is being discussed. There isn't something just called the jab, yeah? In China, nobody's having a Pfizer jab. Nobody. Zero. Zilch.
Well, I mean, he's talking about in Gloucester, isn't he?
But the point is that there's a tendency for people to see the world from where they sit in the Western countries and not to see the bigger picture. I didn't hear anything from Piers Corbyn there about the possibility of biowarfare. And when we know that 9/11 was an inside job and that biological warfare was used extensively in the Korean War to try and deal with the North Koreans, and that the Japanese biological warfare program was taken over lock, stock and barrel at the end of World War II into the Western powers' orbit, and that the NATO countries, as Russians and Chinese will point out, have developed all sorts of biological warfare laboratories on their borders, then I think that people are missing the point. This is warfare. It involves creation of fear. It involves making money out of vaccines. All of that I haven't got a problem with. But the idea that we don't have to have any lockdowns because it doesn't really exist, and if we just let it flow through the population, everything will be okay, I don't buy that at all.
So wasn't World War II supposed to be about stopping the destruction of Christian civilization?
Well, it was basically...
Well, that's what Winston Churchill pitched it to everybody.
Well, that's what, yes, but only in this country. It certainly wasn't seen that way in Russia or China. In China, it was about driving out the Japanese and defeating the Kuomintang. In Russia, it was about, you know, basically stopping the Nazis taking over their raw materials and killing. And that, of course, the Russians had and the Soviets had the worst casualties of anybody.
Anyway, we'll be back after the break with a bit more from Piers Corbyn talking about the what's called the ULEZ. This is on Monday. There's a new charge for everybody in London. The most important point, I suppose, being that the old emission charge, which was just in very much in central London, never applied to residents. We're now talking about something like 3 million Londoners are going to be having to pay a charge every time that they if they've got a diesel vehicle. Also trying to get them to buy brand new vehicles because apparently they don't have to pay. Even Volkswagens, and of course they don't fix their emissions at all, do they? So join us in a minute as we take a weekly look around the world, a little Bible quote, and then we'll have a bit of music. Again, doing my best to find some good Christian music, you know, something that's a bit more groovy than and not dirge-like. So, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither has entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. That's Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, 9 to 12. At the Hammersmith Odeon back in 1976, Carl Santana, Sister Dance from the Moonflower double LP. And before that, Everything's All Right from 1973 from Jesus Christ Superstar. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The big news next week is, Martin, going to be quite obviously Julian Assange, a two-day hearing, which is taking place. It's next Wednesday and next Thursday, which will determine, most likely will determine, whether or not he's going to be extradited to the United States. This is something which he was always, right from the very start, he made clear that the accusations against him in Sweden were really just a ruse to get him to the United States, that the Americans had a vendetta against him for exposing their war crimes.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much the a settled view from people of goodwill, as you know. But when you say it's the big news of next week, it's big news for people like us, but of course the mainstream media will no doubt be banging on about something completely different.
Well, for example, Netflix are repeating some documentary about how terrible Julian Assange is the day before the hearing.
Yeah.
So there is a why is it? Because he was providing some amazing stories. For example, one that I can remember was, you know, this is the stuff of conspiracy theory. What was going on was Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were fleshing out these conspiracy theories and turning them into facts. For example, your television is listening to you and recording you, even though it seems to be off.
Well, yeah, and that's the sort of thing that shivers the spine of the know-nothing punter, if you like. In actual, you know, that is not really... I mean,
it shivers the spine also of the dedicated political activist.
Yes, well, I mean, but every time you go on a computer, you're being watched. I mean, if you want to carry out anti-government activities and not be watched, then you don't use computers or television.
But a computer is not a television, is my point.
No, but I mean...
I mean, okay, so in the Vault 7 release, which I'm referring to, it was also, for example, hacking of aircraft, hacking of cars, hacking of locomotives in order to cause crashes which would kill people, assassinate people by remote control.
Yeah, I think the leaking of the cyber tools used by the CIA, I understand from reading, was the thing that really, really antagonised them. Because, of course, by exposing that, they're exposing the ongoing use of cyber warfare by the CIA.
Before Vault 7, all this stuff was, it was ridiculed. It was conspiracy theory.
Yeah. But I mean,
no one would ever think of doing that. No one would ever think of hacking into a locomotive and causing it to crash.
But what WikiLeaks have done is that there's a whole list of things that they've uncovered. Masses of things. I mean, it's a huge treasure trove of material. And in the early stages, the mainstream media, The Guardian, The New York Times, etc., were more than happy to work with Assange in order to bolster their own credibility as critics of power. But what's happened subsequently is that he's been thrown off out of the balloon because basically he's exposing the nuts and bolts of what goes on. And
actually, the close ties between the mass media and the military, I think that's the key things that
absolutely
is driving this, really.
Yeah. And of course, it's a whole... all of these different things have made him persona non grata to the elites. There's no doubt about it. And as we said the other week, it's very interesting to see who is and who isn't supporting Julian Assange.
Well, one person who I'm afraid is not going to be supporting him is Craig Murray, because at the last hearing of Julian Assange, Craig Murray was doing the best, absolutely brilliant minute-to-minute reporting, daily reporting on those hearings. He himself is now in jail for apparently something completely unrelated, where he was reporting on the Alex Salmond trial.
Yes, and of course, when you say that Craig Murray will be there in spirit supporting Assange, but he
won't be able to
that
brilliant forensics report, those daily reports that he was doing last time.
No, he won't.
What I'm saying here, Martin, is the political prisoners appear to be stacking up, don't they?
They do, and I think Assange is the most significant one. Obviously, I mean, not to take anything away from Craig Murray, who's...
It's the same as going on in the United States. I can't remember the guy's name, but there are several whistleblowers from the military who've exposed crimes. Now, I mean, essentially here, the courts should be looking, with a jury, of course, and there is no jury with Assange. They've managed to get rid of that old concept. God knows how, but I suppose it's some sort of thing the Americans have managed to strong-arm them into. It is the whole point of this hearing. doing is just to get him over to the United States, and it doesn't seem as if there's any kind of, going to be any kind of, well, I mean, we shall see, I suppose. You can't prejudge these things. What's your own view, before we hear from a few other people, about whether or not Assange can be released, or whether he'll be sent to the US?
Well, I think the fact that what happened previously was that they decided that he was extraditable, which I think is just a nonsense, frankly. English law has been completely, this is a scoff law prosecution, because there isn't a shred. He hasn't committed any crime in English law, and you can't be extradited to another country for something that isn't a crime in English law. And in any case, he's an Australian citizen, and he's being charged with, being a traitor to the United States. Doesn't make any sense at all. I think the reason why that by extraditing him to the US, they may find that they've caused more political problems for themselves than by keeping him in the UK, which is why they came up with this cock and bull idea that he couldn't be extradited to the US because of health reasons, but that in fact he should be extradited, but he can't.
Do you think MI6 and the CIA would rather he was just dead and out of the way?
I think they probably would, and we know, and there's been questions asked in the Congress this week in the US about the CIA's attempt to assassinate him. Yeah, they were definitely talking in terms of bumping him off. I mean, this is extraordinary to say, but this is the world we now live in, where, somebody like that, they can openly talk about assassinating him and say, well, what else are we supposed to do? He's such a nuisance. And of course, the fact is that they do assassinate people. They have assassinated people. Aldo Moro, who was the Prime Minister of Italy, was kidnapped supposedly by the Red Brigades and assassinated by NATO. He's a Prime Minister. Never mind, just a journalist. That's how bad it is, and it was that bad in 1979. It's worse today.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to what the former GCHQ whistleblower Catherine Gunn has to say about next week's hearing on Julian Assange.
I can't imagine how deeply traumatised he is at this stage, how his health has been damaged, his physical and mental and emotional health. So really, he's been nailed to the cross, as it were. He's done his time. He shouldn't have even done any time, right? This has been an injustice done to him and to his family, to his partner and to his child with her, and to his parents, to his mother and father. It has ripples. It's like a stone in a pond that creates ripples across outwards into the society. The fact that an innocent man who is guilty of nothing is still rotting away in prison creates a sort of collective injury. So the sooner he's out, the better. But I'm afraid the situation now is so dire. Our public officials have told so many lies and are in so deep in these narratives that, I mean, I think they fear, this is what they fear. They fear that they've passed the point of no return now. They cannot row back and save face. They will never be able to save face from this. They will go down in ignominy. And so for them, it's almost like a sunk cost mentality. The past 18, 20 months and the 10 years that Julian Assange has been persecuted, these are sunk costs. They can never be recovered. They see, I think, in order to complete what they set out to do, in order to try and survive this monumental backlash that they would face from the public, is just to plow on regardless. And that's not a pretty outcome at all.
Oh, well, it'd be nice to think that there were some people around that thought Assange was going to be treated fairly and that there was going to be some justice next week, but difficult to find anyone who will say that. I mean, I'm still quite hopeful that there might be some actual rule of law here. I mean, for example, with Neil McAvoy over in Wales, he was being prosecuted. He's the independent. He was an independent member of the Senedd, and he was being prosecuted by South Wales' good old crooked South Wales police, and the judge threw the case out this week. Great to hear about that. But, you know, there are some cases, and I think, you know, there are various people who have been suggesting that, you know, there is actually some sort of system by which, on important political cases, certain judges are put in charge of that case to make sure they get the right outcome.
Yeah, I think the difference is that Neil McEvoy is a relative small fry, and Julian Assange, for better or worse, is a big fish, and therefore a lot more effort has been put into. And of course, the purpose of giving him this very, very hard time is to send a very clear message to anybody else who might think doing the sort of thing he's done, that we will come after you, etc., etc., etc. And that's why they do it. That's the only justification for it, really, from their point of view. But I think they have got themselves, as Catherine Gunn was hinting there, into a bit of an impasse here. Because if they extradite him, and he goes to the US and gets 120 years in prison or whatever it is, we've got evidence that they were talking of assassinating him, that is going to be more publicity for him and his cause than if they just keep him banged up in Belmarsh. On the other hand, if they keep him banged up in Belmarsh, it's a running sore that they don't know what to do with. And as she pointed out, if they release him, then they look stupid. So it's a pretty poor situation from his point of view, but it's a no-win situation from their point of view as well. Ultimately, of course, the Russians and people like that point to Assange and say, you say we can't prosecute Navalny for being a fraudster. We've actually got evidence that Navalny's a fraudster, and he's also done things that are against our code of what he's supposed to do, you know, in terms of insulting veterans and so on and so forth. All of which is, you know, you may dispute it, but it's above board. What's happened with this Julian Assange is that he's basically done what he's supposed to be. You know, the US Constitution protects freedom of speech in theory, and yet he's being prosecuted for exactly that. It's a mockery.
Well, I talked to several people this week about both these. Another issue too, which is the imposition of the ULEZ in London, which is this low emission zone, which is going right out around the north and to the North and South Circular roads, including many, many people. I spoke to Heiko Koo, who's on the London radio station Resonance FM up until recently with his Speaker's Corner programme, fantastic show, cancelled by Resonance FM, rather like we were cancelled by BCFM here, frustratingly, but he is soldiering on just as we are. But I spoke to Heiko, and I spoke to a guy called Councillor John Moss, just because he runs something called Stop ULEZ, which is about the campaign to try and stop the Labour Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, imposing this £12.50 charge on everybody in a diesel car that's not brand new, that's driving around in London. So let's start with having a listen. I also talked to Heiko about Julian Assange. I mean, he's got some, I think, quite interesting insights into. He runs these tours, which are the Karl Marx tours every week. And again, like that interview you just heard from Catherine Gunn, I'll put the full version up if you're interested in hearing the rest of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And here also with Heiko Koo. But we'll have a listen to what Heiko's got to say about Julian Assange. And also, I mean, he talks about getting assaulted himself. He's saying that he thinks there's an absolute, like, physical and judicial assault on intellectuals in Britain at the moment.
My guess will be the state will send him to the States. I mean, my guess will be this is the territory we've entered. And don't forget, for example, linked in with all this anti-China hysteria was this recent decision by the British, the Australians, and the Americans to organise that the Australians will push out the French and take nuclear weapons. Was it from nuclear powered submarines, was it from Britain or from America or Britain, one or the other? Yeah, there's a multi-billion pound deal stoking up the flames of war for no reason whatsoever. And the type of reasoning that becomes, if you like, the type of background subconscious layer is to stoke up this idea associated with Wuhan Lab and that sort of thing, that the Chinese are going around basically spreading disease around the world and deliberately poisoning people, and, you know, some grand conspiracy to destroy the planet as well. And Assange is a victim of the entire global power of the international tech companies who fear. I mean, they do fear, but there was an enormous power. You know, when YouTube shut down my channel, they took all my videos off. So 15 years of videos, 240 videos, most of which I don't have a copy of. And they delete you from history. At least your record of your material is deleted from history. And then they threatened me. Basically, they said, if you come to our offices again, we will take, you know, further action. Well, what is the further action they can take? And then I checked, and I saw that Google can actually delete you totally from the entire Google network. What does that mean? Well, I've got a Huawei phone. My Huawei phone won't work. What if you've got a Google phone? Your phone will not work. And so they can exclude you, like a, you know, like the passports they're trying to talk about for vaccination. They can exclude you from society. And they've certainly done that with us. I mean, you know, when I went to the World Transformed a few weeks ago at the Labour Party conference, and I just tried to get a question in, I was attacked and beaten up in front of Jeremy Corbyn. And this is supposed to be the people. I mean, these are people who say, yes, support the Extinction Rebellion sitting on the street. But if you stand up and ask a question at a Labour Party, left-wing Labour Party meeting, you get physically assaulted. I was punched in the face. I did an interview with the police just this morning about it. Bruises all over my body. And it wasn't just once. It was twice they did this. I went to a second meeting. I went in disguise with a wig on and a mask on. And with alongside peers, we were both wore wigs and masks. We went inside the event. We stood outside in an open air environment in the pouring rain. And we invited people. When their meeting finished, they had a rally. When their rally finished and people were coming out, we said, well, why don't we debate? And we're prepared to forgive you for attacking us the other day. What did they do? Attack us again. And so a psychology has been created, particularly amongst the what I would call the liberal left, who may call themselves far left or whatever, but they're liberal. They're liberal in the sense that they adopt all the agenda of big tech and big pharma around the world, all the agenda on climate, all the agenda on coronavirus, all the agenda on restrictions. They adopt them as some sort of virtue signal that they must support, and that these are somehow, I don't know, communistic or socialistic objectives, you know, look after health, you know, advance the technology to save the planet. And because of that, they also adopt the hysterical approach to dissidents, which is in complete contradiction with what, for example, Rosa Luxemburg said. Freedom is always and only the freedom for those who think differently to you. And the left should stand up and take notice of what she said at that time. And what was said, I'm just printing out posters at the moment. I'll quote you from Karl Marx. He said, under constant medical tutelage, life would be regarded as an evil and the human body as an object for treatment by medical institutions. Is not death more desirable than life? That is a mere preventative measure against death. Does not life involve also free movement? What is an illness except life that is hampered in its freedom? And so, you know, these people simply know nothing about what democracy and freedom is. And they represent a caste, a sort of bureaucratic, often linked into the public sector caste of people who think they know better than everybody else. And it's infiltrated every single institution of modern intellectual thought. So it's infiltrated the study of cosmology. It's infiltrated the study of astrophysics, cosmology. It's infiltrated the study of illnesses and disease. Marx had a very clear view on disease. He thought disease was created by social conditions. He didn't think the agents were responsible for disease, not the general disease that people get. He thought that life expectancy and so on could be extended by improving the living standards of the masses. And that was proven up until the Second World War. As living standards rose, life expectancy rose and healthcare and health outcomes for people improved, despite the lack of advance in medical treatments at the time, or lack of significant advance in comparison to the numbers of people whose lives were being improved. And so he regarded, like Frederick Engels, the condition of the working classes to be the foundation for their health, not this or that drug or pharmaceutical intervention. And in economics, we've had econometrics and all sorts of lunatics involved from business schools and Harvard and Stanford and God knows what, getting Nobel Prizes for economic projects that destroy the economy. And then we've got the whole climate discussion where that's a taboo to even ask any questions. And so we have this snuffing out of critical intellectual thinking, starting with the intellectuals.
Well, I mean, I would agree with him that social conditions are really the cause of major illnesses. And, you know, for example, the biggest killer on the planet of children is diarrhea from dirty water. It's quite simple. That's what kills them. And it's nothing to do, you know, vaccines won't protect you against that. You just need to have clean water, which, of course, is a big issue in many countries and so on. So in a sense, that's true. I don't know what happened.
I mean, the social conditions in Britain between the wars were pretty appalling, weren't they? Particularly after the crash in 29.
Yeah, but at the same time, the point is well made that the biggest advances in social welfare were things like provision of clean water, yeah, rather than, you know, fancy drugs and hospitals.
Adequate housing.
Yes, it's pretty obvious that these basic.
Being discussed at all, is it?
No, because there's a tendency for people to, you know, I mean, we know
because that housing is heading in a direction of more squalor. Actually, yes, at the moment.
Well, indeed, exactly. So, what, you know, when we're talking about improving people's health, one of the things that really undermines people's health is living in lousy housing. But of course, the lousy housing is the planned outcome of the property bubble economy that Britain has bet the farm on for, you know, 50 or 60 years. I mean, it's the other side of it. You know, some people are making lots of money as their houses rise in value, and some people are dying in the street.
His substantial point there, which is he's gone along to this the world transformed thing, which is this kind of within the Labour Party and the left.
Well, yeah, it's a left. It's not so much a Labour Party; it's a left thing with some, you know, Labour Party.
But it seems to me, this is a sort of pro-Starmer group where they are, apparently. I mean, this is, if you look at their literature, they're saying, well, you know, we want a big change in the left because and this is why we elected Starmer. But then he gets attacked and assaulted at this group, which I find fascinating. But what he's talking, as we heard from last week, from somebody else, I can't remember off the top of my head, but someone else was talking about the failure of the left.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I mean, the failure of the left is an ongoing argument that the left has with itself. You know, why haven't we won yet? Can I just come back to the point about the world transformed? The world transformed is not a Starmer. I mean, this is more worrying in a way. If it was a Starmerite kind of bullying tactics thing, then you could say, well, that's the Starmerites, and that's what you expect from Starmerites. It's actually these people are to the left of the Starmerites. Yeah. They are, you know, the momentum, really. That's how I would describe them, although the World Transformed, of course, is its own organisation. So the fact that they are being intolerant towards others who perceive themselves to be even further left is a worry. Now, that doesn't mean I actually agree with everything that Piers Corbyn and his colleague there believe. But on the other hand, I don't think punching people in the face is much of an argument.
Well, okay, so the world transformed, someone called Mark Montegrifo, apparently, well, this is in an article on Labour List, says many of the left voted for Starmer after the 2019 election defeat because of this narrative of whether or not we were going to be electable. And also, of course, his 10 pledges. So, I mean, they are, you know, really saying that this is, you know, we're trying to be behind Starmer.
We're trying to be, but then don't think of these people as Starmer's natural constituency. They're not. They're people like me who voted for Starmer because we didn't really see any alternatives, because often there isn't an alternative. You're often choosing between
People like Heiko that turn up at an event like this, who is broadly agreeing with them, saying, well, people voted for Starmer, but, you know, things seem to be drifting from that, actually gets physically assaulted twice.
Well, people shouldn't be physically assaulted even if their views are reprehensible. I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, that's just basic stuff. But you will find that, you know, the left has often had, I mean, there are big splits on the left, for example, in this country between the pro, PKK, anarchist wing, if you like, who are actually cooperating with the US Marines at the moment, of course, the YPG, and the people like myself who would probably be more oriented towards the Syrian government. Now, in Syria itself, this is a fighting, shooting war. And of course, that does spill over to conferences and meetings in this country where there's going to be, you know, strong feelings on both sides.
Anyway, I think it's probably going to be our last clip on Assange, and we're happy to have, obviously, having more on that next week when we know the result of this hearing. Hopefully we will by next week's show. And this is, this time it's Piers Corbyn's turn, and he doesn't just talk about Julian Assange here, and what he believes is he's not committed any crime, so what on earth is he even doing sitting in a hearing on sitting in Belmarsh high security prison? One does wonder, Martin, whether he's in Belmarsh to stop anybody who might be trying to rescue him, to getting him out of there rather than the other. He's obviously not the sort of person who's dangerous, so what on earth is he doing in this high security prison? It's because it's a place where political prisoners go, I suppose. And it'd be interesting to see if Assange and both Assange and Craig Murray could be housed in the same building. That would be very interesting, the same prison.
Well, so they could, Craig Murray and Scotland
could chit chat with each other. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? But anyway, here's Piers Corbyn, who I interviewed this week. Again, a full version of this, as with Heiko Koo, and everyone, or the other interviews this week, about, so he starts off by talking about Julian Assange, and he goes on to talk about Bill Gates being in London and his attitude to this imposition of this new tax on poorer Londoners, which includes, by the way, disabled people. For the first time, disabled people also have to pay this fine charge thing, which is coming in on Monday, the ULEZ, going right the way out, all the way to the North and South Circular Roads.
It's an utter abomination. You see, that is just the government showing that they are supine grovellers to whatever the USA wants.
But this is the judiciary, surely, not the government.
Well, true. But the judiciary on matters of high state often just toe the government's line, as you've probably noticed. I mean, there are some independent judges around. That is true. That is true. But you see, what is the process involved in putting a judge in charge of a case? Now, that process is shrouded in mystery. And I would suggest on these sort of things, whoever is in charge of these things, make sure that the right sort of judge, from their point of view, is in charge.
I suppose both on the you can't pay, won't pay for the emission charge, and also on the Julian Assange. I just wondered if you are going to be campaigning on these two issues, particularly yourself, and if people are interested in supporting Assange and opposing the Sadiq Khan's new charge within the South Circular. What actions can people take, Piers?
Well, first of all, on a Julian Assange, we let the UK live, fully support the Julian Assange campaign because he's a symbol of free speech, which is under attack by the coronavirus legislation, which is a cover for taking away our rights. And you can get in touch with the latest events just look typing up Julian Assange, but also on our website, lettheuklive.com. Can't pay, won't pay. People join in. We have a Telegram group, ULEZ Can't Pay, Won't Pay. It's a public group. Anyone can join. Just join in, find out what, and on the day, on the 25th of October, we'll have some convoys of cars driving around. We'll have stickers in cars saying, ULEZ can't pay, won't pay, and we will not pay any of the
charges. So one of the things people can obviously do is put a sticker on their bumper or whatever. This is the traditional US way of doing things, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we can do that in London too. Hey, if people want a sticker, how do they get hold of one?
They just get one. Go to that Telegram group I mentioned, ULEZ Can't Pay, Won't Pay. Just type in ULEZ and it will turn up, actually. Or come to lettheuklive.com and you'll be able to download them or come along to our events and we'll give them out. We're having thousands printed as we speak. I think the aim of it is to destroy small businesses because, well, that will be the consequence, because it's not just cars, it's anything that's not very new. Including vans. So a lot of white van men will be, or white van mans or whatever, will be bankrupted because they can't afford new vehicles. And I think it's important to also understand it will not reduce pollution at all, because people driving from outside London going through London will now go all around the North or South Circular Roads and increase their journey distance and make, therefore, more pollution. physical event for the ULEZ Can't Pay, Won't Pay will be this Monday when they officially open or start this monstrosity. And it could turn into a new London poll tax resistance. I'm completely serious, because all these cars, people having these jumped up charges onto them is a monstrosity. So that is one event. There are many other events going
on. Whereabouts?
We'll probably meet at Elephant and Castle, but we'll advertise that on our website, and it's likely we'll drive to Thamesmead, where during the election, almost everybody on Thamesmead Estate, which is along the River Thames in South London, as you probably know, were totally against the ULEZ extension, because that was mooted by Khan during the election, and a lot of them voted for me as a consequence. In that election, I got 55,000 first or second preferences. So that means 55,000 different people voted for me. So, you know, there's a lot of people around who understand the issues. And, you know, the ULEZ issue was one of the biggest things that people supported us about.
Okay, so that sounds like a bit of a convoy going from Elephant and Castle up to Thamesmead on Monday. Yeah. What time?
I expect we'll leave about 12. Okay. But I'm not completely certain of those times yet. We've got to agree with people who are bringing cars from West London, maybe. But that's very likely. And again, go to lettheuklive.com for details. But for information today, I'm being Parliament Square. We're going to march from Parliament Square to Bill Gates' headquarters to take down Bill Gates. We want to close his headquarters by surrounding it, which is quite easily done.
Well, that's another point, isn't it? Actually, Gates was in London. What's he doing over here at the moment? I noticed just at the time of this renewal of the Coronavirus Act.
Exactly. Well, that's there. He's there. On behalf of the mega corporations of the world, the big pharmaceutical industries, to make sure the government complies. And they've got one is the monstrosity of big pharmaceutical and the jabbing of children, which is going to result in injuries and deaths of many. And Bill Gates is also talking more about the climate nonsense. He's decided to write a little book on climate, another subject on which he knows nothing, but that is there to propagate the fake religion of man-made climate change, which of course is the underlying justification for almost everything they do.
I've noticed also that Bill Gates is buying up a fantastic amount of farmland, and he's also got this Svalbard seed vault in Greenland, I think it is, or Iceland, yeah. Where he's trying to keep copies of all the world's seas, a bit like a kind of version of Noah's Ark or something.
Yeah, well, it's all evil for control, you see, because they want genetically modified crops and they want genetically modified humans. I know it's difficult to grasp this, but that is what they want. That is what the technocracy theory being put into practice is about. That's what
and it's interesting that Bill Gates has got his London HQ. Whereabouts is it?
It's up Victoria Street, it's number 62 Buckingham Gate. So it's on the right as you go up Victoria Street. Not very far up there. Number one is a government building doing climate nonsense. And then about, I don't know, a few blocks further up, there's Bill Gates on the right at that junction.
And so what entity is it? Is it the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation there?
It's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation European office is there.
Okay. Piers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, Svalbard, where the seed vault is of Bill Gates, where he's planning to hijack the entire world's crop genetic material, a bit like some kind of Bond villain, from Her Majesty's Secret Service, is in Greenland by the... Oh, sorry, no, it's not. It's in Norway, the Barents Sea. You're quite right, Martin. It's not in Iceland or in Greenland. It's in the very north of Norway. So that's where apparently all the world's crop genetic material is being kept. What do you make of this ULEZ, this emission charge thing in London, Martin? Is it something that bothers you at all or not? Because let's just think from a general lefty point of view, it's not, it's actually targeting the poorest. Anyone that's just spent 50 grand on a new diesel Chelsea tractor doesn't even have to pay it.
Well, I mean, there are obviously a number of different issues that are being dealt with in that little clip from Piers Corbyn. The Svalbard place was originally supposedly a public sector repository of genetic material.
Oh, like the AstraZeneca project.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, but I mean, there may well be that Bill Gates is trying to muscle in and take it over, but it was originally conceived as exactly that. As, you know, somewhere to keep all the seeds that make sure that, you know, so that things, you know, in the future you need to drag up an ancient seed, you it'll be kept there. And the reason they put it there, of course, is it's very cold and, you know, it's underground and it's a perfect place to keep them, apparently. But of course, this is things which were conceived of as public goods are being privatised. So it's very worrying that somebody like Gates has got his finger in there. Doesn't surprise me, by the way, but there it is. This ULEZ thing, well, I mean, there's going to be different views about this. I haven't got strong views either way, but lots of people are going to say, well, hang on a minute, we've got to do something about air pollution in London. Now, this may be the wrong thing, and there's a debate to be had about whether it's the right or wrong thing, but ultimately, of course, what we should have had is a free public transport system in London, which is what Ken Livingstone wanted to bring in years ago. And, of course, we're not doing any of that.
Well, that would have been carrot. This is stick.
Yes.
And also, it's going to be affecting disabled people massively. I mean, we'll be hearing in a little while a bit more about the detail of what's going on in London from Councillor John Moss. But, you know, it's a massive, massive change, isn't it? And I think
if you're going to carry out massive... in order to deal with ecological problems, you're going to take fairly drastic action. And it may be, the case may be made that drastic action has to be taken with this or other issues. You've got to build into that a massive redistribution of wealth.
This is the opposite, though.
Well, of course, if you bring this in without a massive redistribution of wealth, you're going to get a reaction. So the yellow vests in France broke out because they were basically... The ordinary people with ordinary cars are being made to pay the costs for reducing carbon footprints. Whereas in actual fact, it should be, you know, if you're going to do that, you've then got to actually tax the rich. Now, there's no suggestion that we're going to tax the rich. So, and this is, look at what happened with the national insurance contributions to pay for social care.
It's
the poor paying for the poor.
As if what's going on in London is a kind of test case for what they're planning to do here in Bristol next year. Bringing in the emission zone, which is also going to be applying apparently to commercial vehicles, to cabs, which of course it shouldn't do. Cabs are public transport, and all these sorts of things. So the Mayor Marvin Rees had his annual State of the City address this week here in Bristol. The Bristol City Council website publishes that. It's a live stream and then it's up on YouTube, but they don't allow any comments. Oh, that's nice, isn't it? Publicly funded, but the public can't comment on it. So you'll find my version, which is just the speech itself rather than the preamble, which is some rather tedious poetry, and the discussion afterwards, which is all completely managed without any kind of spontaneity allowed. Everyone has got to sit there and obediently watch the thing. And Andrew Kelly, as the Master of Ceremonies, who I worked with for many years on the Bristol Cultural Development Partnership, who seems to be the business representative, have slowly hijacked the whole idea of cultural services and the money that used to go to accountable public sector people. He now channels it through to his personal friends, and Marvin Rees obviously now goes along with that, being our Blairite Labour mayor. So anyway, let's have a listen to Marvin's transport policies, which include shutting down Park Street, one of the most important big thoroughfares in the city, which runs from the centre, which is the old quay, the docks here, right up to Clifton.
On transport, our flagship policy remains the mass transit system, including the underground. All routes have been identified, linking the north, east, south and airport to the city centre. It will integrate buses and trains and include new stations to form a transformative, low-carbon transport system for Bristol. We laid the foundations with our bus deal, with First Bus. This gives priority to bus travel to support growth in passenger numbers. This is a key step in building the business case that will secure the over £4 billion investment needed for the mass transit system. We've introduced bus prioritisation, including bus gates on Bristol Bridge and Baldwin Street. This has increased reliability and taken 5 minutes of bus journeys through the city centre. We delivered new city centre bike lanes, pedestrianised the old city, King Street, Cotton Hill, Princess Street, Princess Victoria Street, and four pilots are now running for school streets, which close roads outside schools at drop-off and pick-up times. We're about to launch a consultation on the introduction of bus prioritisation for the Wells Road to the city centre, over the Downs, and the whole length of the A4018. And we're going to ask you to comment on proposals to remove parking on that route that causes congestion on key routes, and the closure of Park Street to private cars. This has the potential to reinvent the public realm up to the Triangle and remove rat runs from the Downs. We submitted the full business case for the Clean Air Zone, which will come into force next year. We're negotiating with government now a package of support, including £2 million for clean buses, £720,000 for a new cycle scheme through Old Market, free electric bike loans and cycle training, free bus tickets, discount on car club membership, support to buy electric vehicles, and financial support for business and residents to upgrade from polluting building vehicles. We estimate the Clean Air Zone will reduce traffic travelling into the city centre by around 2,000 vehicles per day, while delivering protections for lower paid workers, hospital patients and visitors, and blue badge holders. Over half a century ago, Bristol lost its trams. 20 years ago, lost out on an opportunity for super trams. This was down to poor leadership, impenetrable council structures and regional squabbles. We have the opportunity today to get beyond these historical failures and deliver something transformative. We need government funding and support, and we must ensure that the West of England Combined Authority unlocks the investment Bristol and the city region needs. We need substance, not sound bites.
Well, plenty of sound bites there from our marvellous Marvin the Mayor, Marvin Rees, talking about transport here. Martin, he's quite clearly creating this hostile environment for cars. One of the points, though, is that we've got actually very increasingly clean air in the city because of all the measures that have been taken during COVID to stop the vehicles moving around the city, closing off the main reason that Bristol is here, that is to say Bristol Bridge, which the city gathered around, stopping vehicles going through there. It's created this kind of congestion all around the centre, but the actual centre itself is reasonably clean already, so it doesn't seem as if we really need to impose a tax on people who are driving through Bristol now.
Well, I mean, there are going to be different views about this, aren't there? And I'm not going to take a strong stance either way, but the point is, of course, from Marvin's point of view, that there was an election which he won, and the Greens, who came second, probably support virtually everything that he said in that speech. So a minority may disagree, and they may be right, but the fact is that that's what he wants to do, and he's got the mandate to do it.
But it's kind of myth-making there, I think. That's what I heard when I'm listening to his speech, all this stuff about the bus deal. Well, he's painting it out to be some sort of marvellous thing. The bus deal has happened, but a lot of buses just don't arrive. They're very unreliable, and the fares all went up.
Well, that's because the privatisation of the bus system in the 1980s by the Thatcher government. Absolutely
ridiculous.
Why is
he trying to sell this as some sort of, you know, oh yes, we are going to reduce the number of cars, but we've done this bus deal. Well, actually, the bus deal is no good for people that want to use public transport.
All right, well, you may say that
it's just called the bus deal. It's okay. Just something which is kind of, you know, being thrown out there as some great, you know, alternative.
I understand that the criticism of Marvin is that he often comes up with these sort of grandiose plans like the Underground, for example.
Are you saying that that is still going to happen?
Yes,
apparently,
okay.
A lot of civil engineers are saying you can't do
all
it in
right.
Bristol. Sorry,
I get all of that, but I come back to my main point that he stood in an election on exactly these proposals and he won. And even if the second place candidate, the Green Party guy whose name now escapes me,
Sandy Hall Ruthven,
had won, then pretty much the same sort of proposals would have come forward. And we've now got a split on the council between the Labour Party and the Green Party. I mean, that's the political battle here in Bristol. And the overwhelming consensus is something like this will have to be done. Now, that doesn't mean that they're right or that even that it's workable.
It'd be interesting.
I'm just pointing out that they've won an election on the basis of
it. How they get it on in London with this ULEZ that they're starting on Monday. It may be that that, well, I mean, what Piers Corbyn was saying was that the can't pay, won't pay may be something as big as the poll tax, because you're talking about vast amounts of money that hundreds of thousands of Londoners are going to suddenly have to pay from Monday.
Well, as he pointed out, 55,000 people voted for him. But, of course, a hell of a lot more people voted for Sadiq Khan. More,
the London elections were really about voting against the Tories, voting for someone who voters think will be against the Tories. They're nothing to do with an endorsement of Sadiq Khan.
No, well, I mean, that's a problem with all politics.
Same here
it?
In Bristol.
With all politics, especially under first past the post, you're forced to vote for the alternative if you don't want the other side to win.
Okay,
and that's why you need to change the system.
We're going to be revisiting Heiko Kuh now, and here he is, because he's done quite a lot of digging into Extinction Rebellion and where they're coming from, because they're obviously driving much of this agenda, and they're supported by Sadiq Khan and by our own Mayor Marvin Rees here in Bristol, very much a protest movement that have been shutting the M25 through their little splinter group called Insulating Britain.
I think there's a combo here. On the one side, from a theoretical point of view, this guy, Roger Hallam, who was one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, his PhD is based around how you tip the balance in a debate, a political debate, and it, like in society, and how you should create a paradigm shift. And his theory, based on some observations of some protests around the world and his selection of data associated with them, argues that if you have a determined group of people who are prepared to go to be incarcerated or to be arrested or, you know, you go to jail or be arrested temporarily, and are prepared to take a militant enough action to compel the police to arrest you, then either the police will arrest, will back off arresting, in which case you've achieved some victory, or the police will arrest, and then if you've got enough people committed to being arrested, then, you know, it can fill up the whole legal processes, and they, you know how many police cells they've got, how many available staff they've got, and so on, so you can clog up the system. And then in terms of strategic targets, if you can pick targets that have maximum impact with minimum numbers, so if one person can block a road or five people can block a road by gluing themselves to the floor, and you know that the road is a major artery for the maintenance of the economy and society, then, you know, then you've got a strategic weak point, haven't you? And so that's the theory he's got. So his theory is that if you've got 3% of the population on your side, then eventually you'll win a majority. So now, of course, the question begs itself, well, does that mean anyone who wants to get 3% could do whatever they like to try and get attention? And that's basically what they do. And during the first wave of Extinction Rebellion protests, there were people who went to the meetings and they were basically asked to fill out a piece of paper. And it says, are you prepared to be arrested? Are you prepared to go to prison? Tick here, tick there. Were you prepared to volunteer? And so it was basically this structure. And he tried to create a network of primarily middle class people sympathetic to the Greens, who lack perhaps a mission in their life and the salvation of humanity from bad weather, or better said, long-term bad weather impacts of whether it be natural or man-made. The idea is that it's man-made. That by creating this network that appeals to this layer of the population, that you could create a movement, and they certainly have done that. Whether it's a genuine, organic grassroots movement is another question. They certainly have very big supporters, and it seems to me it's a pincer operation. On the one side, you have the sort of appearance of a grassroots movement, although definitely the numbers have declined dramatically who are participating in this movement, compared with the first year or like just the year before the pandemic, in inverted commas. But at the same time, to have a layer within the institutions of the state and corporate and the biggest corporations in the world who declare their sympathies with these protests. So I may not like the method they use, but I'm fully sympathetic with everything they do. And so you cover every angle. You've got, you know, the person who blocks, sticks themselves on the floor or climbs a tree and hangs from it, and or you know, risks their life to block whatever, X, Y, and Z. That's the grassroots protest level, or the school students who go on strike thinking the climate's worse than ever before. And on the other side, people like Paul Polman, the former CEO of Unilever, one of the largest corporations in the world, or used to be one of the largest corporations in the world, and Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of England. Now the Queen has expressed her indignation at the irritation at the lack of progress, whatever that means. Again, aligning herself, and she's hardly the person to sit down in a road sticking herself with glue, aligning herself with people who are doing that. So it's that combination of trying to present a united front of everyone who's concerned about the world, using all means possible, government meetings like COP26 and street protests that blockade roads. And eventually the press will cover it. Well, if there's ever been a story that's been saturated coverage in the press, other than coronavirus, it's climate change. Climate change has to be the number one story in the press everywhere in the world, or almost everywhere in the world, and without really any justification. Literally, you know, you can literally have a couple of days of bad weather and it will be attributed to climate change. If it gets cold, we're told it's caused by climate change. If it gets warm, we're told it's caused by climate change. If there's no wind, we're told it's caused by climate change. If it's very windy, we're told it's caused by climate change. So it's a catch-all, and it's catching all in terms of, you know, you just observe today's weather. I mean, it's very unusual for this time of the day to have this type of weather. And, you know, I'm sure it'll be the same all day long and all year long and forever onwards. But it covers everybody. So you cover all the protests and you cover all the climatic conditions. So it's the perfect catch-all for everything. This is unfortunately, the degeneration of the so-called left, the Labour Party and the socialists in Britain, but also around the world, as they've adopted this narrative of the big technology companies that they are the saviors of humanity, as if using a mobile phone or buying bitcoins or using a computer is somehow green. I mean, it's preposterous. I was looking around my house today, how many machines and equipment and so on, and I haven't got a lot of these things, but how many of these things have you got stuck in your house now? And how many of them do you throw away when you want to get a new one? And how many resources? You know, they've all got huge amounts of plastic and electronics and rare earth metals and so on. So it's the plunder of the earth in the name of saving the earth. That's the game. Because none of the proposals they are making will ever be able to bring down carbon emissions to zero, or even probably to net zero. But net zero is such a con anyway that it's ridiculous. But yes, the miners were being supported. And Arthur Scargill correctly used to say, we have the cheapest deep mine coal in the world. The only reason it was more expensive than other countries was because we were paying the pensions of people who had become ill or were dying. Who had been working in the mines, you know, and they had a lot of miners in the past, and so there were a lot of people who were on pensions, and you took away the pensions from the costs of deep mine, or from the cost of the coal mining industry in Britain, and coal was efficient, and in China they continue producing coal, and of course gas is essential, because without wind, you know, about a week and a half ago there was a report on the BBC saying that there's not enough wind in Britain to make the wind farms work properly, and wind has gone down by 20%. And then they had some idiotic modelers who started with the fact wind gone down 20% because they couldn't provide the electricity without firing up the gas power stations that are backups for the wind when it dies down. And they said the reason why the wind has gone down is because of climate change. I mean, you can't make it up.
Well, that's Heiko Kuh. One more clip from him, Martin, but he's really talking there about Extinction Rebellion. Again, he's suggesting, I suppose, in our terms, in our language, it's a kind of counter gang. It's been created and constructed for a certain purpose, and that's a small, tiny minority of people getting a massive an appearance of a massive movement.
Well, I hear what's being said there. Just to put the other side of the argument in terms of devil's advocate, if you like, I was reading this week there's been a survey of the literature on climate change and looking at all of the different things that have been said about it and saying that it's the scientific consensus is overwhelming that it is man-made. Now, the listeners can make what they like of that. I think what, from my point of view, is pretty clear is that climate change, even if it is a major threat, is not nearly as major a threat as the thing that used to worry us, which is nuclear war, because we're much closer to nuclear war than people realise, and that really will change the climate. And, of course, the other thing that climate change does is, instead of talking about the rapacious capitalist system and the banking crisis, which began in 2008, we're now talking about reducing carbon emissions as if that's the main issue. Now, I'm not saying whether carbon emissions are or not the main issue, because it strikes me that what we need to do is we need to reduce our footprint of what we do, whether you believe in climate change or not.
Well, actually, what's happening is it's just being transferred from fossil fuels to things like nuclear.
Well, indeed, I mean, that's another interesting conundrum, isn't it? Because nuclear power is being pushed as a carbon-friendly technology.
They're not thinking that
there
might be a war.
But in actual fact, it involves massive sunk costs, which, you know, concrete and all the rest of it, which involve huge and mining of uranium, for example.
And
in places
waste,
like,
and dealing
like
with
Namibia.
The waste, for example.
Yeah, and dealing with the waste. Now, in other words, what's happened over my lifetime is that green ideas, which started off as marginal ideas and were very much, you know, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation, which was founded by E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, which came out in 71. You know, what's happened is that the big boys have muscled in on it and we're all green now. Now, there's clearly a big question mark over that.
Okay, and this particularly a big question mark over this new tax being imposed on Londoners from Monday, as to whether it's going to work and whether it's going to actually be resisted in London and whether it's going to be here in Bristol next year. So I also asked, final clip from Heiko Kuh, about the ULEZ charge and what he sees as these Extinction Rebellion types and those that want this kind of thing, think it's going to be a good thing. They're really setting themselves up as gods.
A friend of mine works in the building industry. He had a van that was 2 years old. And these vans, you know, a diesel van with, you know, it'll go for 200,000 miles if you look after it without any problem. And he'd only just bought it a couple of years before. And then he got £7,000 from the government for London to scrap his old vehicle and buy a new one, which would be ULEZ compliant. And so this, again, is a mechanism by which the technology companies, in conjunction with auto enterprises, get a massive subsidy to boost their investments in creating this infrastructure. And, of course, the whole thing requires a certain infrastructure. And unless you have a sufficient scale of infrastructure, then you could never take off with these projects. And so you have these speculative investments in companies like Tesla. I looked at the figures yesterday for Tesla. I think it was 426 times price earnings ratio, the value of the company. So here you have a purely speculative model of a company based on hype around what they're going to be able to do in the future. You'd be far better off, in my opinion, doing research. You see, their argument is that you need this competition between lots of companies in order to drive forward the innovation. And if, like, one project making these batteries and turns out to be rubbish, well, so be it. And if another project turns out, in the end, you'll have the best player in the marketplace will dominate the market, or the best three or four players will dominate the market and have hyper-efficient battery systems and so on. Or you might be better off just waiting 20 years and developing the systems, first of all, before you go throwing resources at things that are going to be thrown away in a couple of years' time anyway, and will cost the Earth enormous amount of resources, which you can only secure by plundering the oceans, the bottom of the ocean, of the rare earth metals which exist there. And that's the current part of the current projects they've got now, is basically to plunder the seas. And so the idea is you commodify everything, and then you make these commodities everywhere in the world. The ocean becomes a commodity, sea bed becomes a commodity, all animal and plant life become commodities, because all of them might turn up with something useful one day when you know the DNA, the way they work, the RNA and all the rest of it. And so it's about a sort of conquest of potential or theoretically potential marketplaces, and the delusion that man can control everything, can control the climate. And that man, you see, the starting point is, if we want to become God, we imagine that we are already God. So we are already shaping the weather of the planet. That's the theory. So we are God, and therefore we must play the role of God and stop changing the planet. And we haven't figured out the ways to do that yet, but we've got lots of schemes, you know, lots of ways to emulate God. And that's what they're basically doing, you know. And no wonder these people, individuals who control these companies, think they have to go up to space and see God. You know, there was a joke in the Soviet Union. Yuri Gagarin came back. He was the first man in space. He came back from space and he visited Brezhnev. Khrushchev. And Khrushchev calls him into a room in the Kremlin, and he says, ask everyone else to leave the room. And then he says, Yuri, when you got to heaven, or when you went to space, did you see God? And Gagarin says, yes. And Khrushchev goes, I thought so. He goes, not a word to anybody, or you'll never see your family again. And then, Gagarin travels the world, and he goes all many different countries. He ends up visiting the Pope in Rome, and he has a private audience with the Pope, and he shoos all his advisors away, and he says, Yuri, when you got to heaven, did you see God? He says, no. And the Pope says, oh, I thought so. Not a word to anybody, or you'll be condemned for life. So, you know, they think they're God. That's what Elon Musk appears. They think they're God.
So that's the final clip tonight from Heiko Kuh, full interview about an hour long, up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. There he is really talking about the ULEZ charge, the emission zone, London emission zone. Amazing that they're actually managing to get away with this, particularly considering that these previous charges, none of them have included residents, and now they do. Even people who are resident within that zone have got to pay it. Martin, anyway, what do you make what he was saying there about everything else or etc., which he was really talking, I suppose, about the idea of these people just acting like God.
Well, on a more sort of nuts and bolts level, Whitney Webb has got a very good article out that I'm reading this week about they're basically setting up what are supposedly sustainable investment funds, which are, as exactly has been suggested, commodifying nature. Yeah. And this has been an issue going back for many years in the green movement.
This is privatisation or enclosure, really.
Yeah, and in actual fact, you don't need new technology to resolve a lot of ecological problems.
So what
you need is social justice, which is
what
we haven't
about
got.
Is extending the concept of ownership, isn't it? I mean, when Americas were conquered, as we were hearing about from Kamala Harris last week, there was a genocide that took place. But there was also this whole idea of land ownership, the idea that you can have it as your own private property and kick everybody else off. That was completely alien to the Native American culture, and it's the same here in Britain. You know, so when the land was enclosed in the 16th, well, mainly the 18th century, here there was a concept that everybody had to share land. Now there's this whole idea of private land ownership, and every inch has to be privately owned. So this is extending itself almost, ad infinitum into everything. The whole natural world, none of it is common. It's all private.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of right-wing ecological thinking, if you like, behind all of this is that once you've privatized everything, people will look after it, and there will be markets will find solutions automatically. Now, you know, history suggests that that's rubbish, that in actual fact, you've got to preserve collective goods which aren't privately owned. Although I must correct you, the idea that there was no private ownership of land before enclosure is simply wrong.
Well, no. No, I mean, it was...
People had access to land within their community.
Hang on, that's not what I said, is it?
No, but the point is that the idea that
there was a vast amount of common land.
There wasn't a vast amount of common land. There was a tiny
almost
bit.
Almost all villages were common land.
The village belonged to the land lord of the manor.
Yes, but and it was common
of
it, land.
A bit of, yeah. No, it wasn't common land. It belonged to the lord of the manor.
It was common land. Yeah. Let me explain something you don't get here. You have commons, but they're also privately owned, right? The same thing. But the private ownership doesn't mean to say you can do what you want with them.
No.
So you've got a common, which means it's got to be shared.
Yeah,
with
but only
maybe
by,
40,
only by
50
people
or
within,
200 people.
Yeah, only by the in people that in that particular
area.
Village.
So let's just, you know, this is, you're trying to make out that I do know what I'm talking about.
Well, the use of language is rather important, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes. And so all those commons were dissolved during the enclosures in the 17th century, which is the point I was trying to make.
Yes,
which,
I know,
you know,
but the idea, but the point is that in actual fact there was never a golden age when people had access to land. It just wasn't, doesn't exist. They still haven't got access to land. There
well,
are
they
people
had far
fighting
more access than pre-enclosure than they did after enclosure.
Well, indeed,
that's why so many of them ended up
living in
ditches.
I'm not saying that the enclosure was a good thing. I'm just pointing out that in the world today there is massive armed struggles going on in places like Nepal about land ownership.
Well,
and
also,
people are dying and fighting to own land, or rather to control it collectively.
Is that the idea of imposing this idea on the Americas, which wasn't there previously, in this idea of private ownership of land, was something that was also being done to the subjugated people in this country at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism begins with this whole commodification of land, labour,
I mean,
and
we're
all the
end
rest
up
of it.
Surely
of course it
with
does.
One person that owns everything, or one big corporation.
Well,
this is
in the Communist Manifesto. There's a tendency towards monopoly in capitalism. So the idea that capitalists like competition is rubbish.
Actually, there is a new documentary out called Monopoly, which we'll have some clips from next week. But anyway, look, we need to crack on. I did track down a guy called Councillor John Moss, who is the sort of expert on the... He ran for about 4 years or 5 years or maybe even six, a campaign called Stop ULEZ. Obviously, that's not been successful as a campaign, and he found it very difficult to get publicity for it. But anyway, I managed to track him down this week. Councillor John Moss from Waltham Forest... He is explaining that, again, as we were saying, that this congestion charge is not a congestion charge, it's an emission charge in London, is about all stick and no carrot. And also, he explains all the poorer people in London and the disabled who it's going to hit the hardest.
The ULEZ charge is a stick, and it's explicit in the consultation documents that TfL put out back in 2017. The gain in air quality by 2030 had gone. It was projected to be in exactly the same place in 2030 as it would be without the scheme. The benefit came solely from people changing their vehicles early. And what we've seen with the Central London ULEZ coming in 2019, and maybe a bit of pandemic benefit from people who weren't paying a lot of money to commute, saving money and spending that money on new vehicles. We've seen a lot of corporate vehicles change, and we've seen a lot of private vehicles for those who can afford them change. And the rate at which people have taken up compliant vehicles far exceeds what TfL ever predicted. So what we have got is we've got the same number of vehicles driving around. The vast majority of them are compliant and not paying anything. And the difference in pollution is what was expected to be achieved anyway. It's just come a little bit earlier.
Yeah. It almost seems like a kind of help to buy a new car scheme.
Well, there is a scrappage scheme if you're poor enough to benefit from it. But I had a vehicle that wasn't compliant, 2008 BMW X3 diesel. It was actually written off in an accident, not our fault, I hasten to add. But the price, the money we were given for that car was £4,000 lower than it would have been a year earlier, when the expansion of the ULEZ had not been promulgated. And I was able to absorb that. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to absorb that. But again, I go back to the carer working on a minimum wage, using their own car to visit 12, 14, 15 clients a day, shift workers who can't use public transport because they're traveling when public transport's not running. And as I say, older people who have a perfectly good car in which they maybe do 2,000 miles, 3,000 miles a year. One trip to our local hospital from Chingford, and that's £12.50. Forget parking charges at the hospital on top. £12.50 to take your sick partner to hospital. And if you take them at 10 o'clock at night and come back at 2 o'clock in the morning, £25 to do that is a very significant impost. And I don't know how the mayor got that past the equalities and diversity assessment, given the people who work in those industries and older people being classed as a vulnerable group. It does seem very strange to me that that was glossed over. But again, I think it comes back to this PR campaign that London's air is killing people, that thousands of people die every year because of poor air quality. I accept that people die earlier than they might otherwise have done, but the private car and the plumber's van and the carpenter's estate car or whatever is demonized in all this, when actually domestic gas boilers put out more nitrous oxide than all the vehicles, not just the non-compliant ones, all the vehicles in London. And when you come to particulate matter, less than a quarter of it comes from vehicles. Half of it comes from dust that's blown in from agricultural fields around London. So there is this demonization of people who need to use their cars for essential journeys or for work. And the gains, frankly, are marginal and vanishing very rapidly.
Well, it's fascinating to see that this is such a massive expansion of what was actually a fairly small scheme in 2019, you know, in the inner, I think it was in the congestion charge area in the central London. Can you tell us about the difference between these two schemes? Because as I understand it, there's going to be actually, I don't know how many, but maybe even 100,000 people caught up with this new scheme, that whereas the old scheme didn't affect residents, this new one will include all those residents now living, which is, you know, almost probably the majority of Londoners living within the North and South Circular Roads.
Yeah, it's approximately half the population of London live within the North and South Circular Roads.
So how many is that? Do you know?
That will be somewhere around 3.5 million people. That's probably somewhere around 2 million households. And obviously they don't all have cars, and car ownership, you know, households with access to a vehicle in central London and inner London, as it's being termed inside the North and South Circulars, is less than it is in outer London. But nevertheless, I mean, the estimate, I saw one today, there's an estimate that 150,000 vehicles a day might be caught and have to pay the ULEZ charge. And yes, the zone is 100 times bigger than the central London zone, which, as you say, matched the congestion charge zone. And the other egregious aspect of this scheme is that with the expansion goes the residence exemption that was granted to people inside the central London zone. That is disappearing. And there are no exemptions for people who have disabled badges, disabled drivers. The only way a disabled driver gets an exemption is if they have an adapted vehicle and they have to apply for a certificate of exemption. It's not automatic. So if you are that elderly couple with a partner with a gammy knee, or perhaps had an amputation or something like that, then, and you need to take them to hospital, you don't get an exemption because you've got a blue badge. And not a lot of people realise that early on. And it was one of the key points we wanted to get across. And a lot of the disabled groups in London have highlighted the discriminatory nature of the ULEZ, because everywhere else they go and everything else they do, they have an exemption, but they don't have an exemption from the ULEZ charge. And it's £12.50 a day if you move your vehicle inside that zone. If you're working 5 days a week, that's £62.50 a week off your take-home pay.
Councillor John Moss from Stop ULEZ, he's a local councillor in Waltham Forest. Martin, it does sound quite a lot of money, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, obviously, it's not something, this particular issue is not something I've looked into in any great depth, and I hear what he's saying there.
Well, the point and, being, it's in London and it's coming to Bristol next year.
I mean, the only thing I would say in relation to all of this, just to put devil's advocate, if you like, is that both Sadiq Khan and Marvin Rees have recently won elections in which this was in their manifestos. So there you are. I mean, that may be completely wrong. A lot of the arguments being put there, ring home to me. But they didn't win the election, and he did.
Well, there's been very little discussion about the details of it, and some of the details have been hidden. So the idea, for example, that it was the previous zone, residents didn't have to pay it. So people were kind of assuming, it's going to be similar to the old scheme. No, it isn't. It's very different. Residents will have to pay it.
Well, that suggests a tweak, doesn't it?
Also, another final clip with Councillor John Moss is here. He talks about what he thinks he sees as the Extinction Rebellion mindset going on here.
Extinction Rebellion and Insulate Britain and those who claim we are on the verge of an environmental catastrophe if we don't immediately stop doing certain things that we've all worked very hard to be able to afford to do, drive a nice car, take the family on holiday, put the heating on in winter, that sort of thing. If we don't immediately stop doing that, then the planet will die. That is their mindset, and they don't believe that that enough is being done. The UK has reduced its CO2 emissions by 44% since 1997, and a lot of that gain has come in the last 10 years. At the same time, the economy has grown by 70%. And we are one of the countries that has the very best record in terms of reducing our environmental impact. It's small to start with, but we've reduced it substantially. And that gives us a leadership position in the world. But I'm afraid, like most political zealots, and I believe they are zealots, they're not prepared to look at the evidence. And they simply want what they want, and they want it now. And they should put themselves up for election. And if they put themselves up for election, then the people will decide whether they support them or not. Some interesting polling. A lot of people support moves to green our economy, to change vehicles from internal combustion engine to electric, to reduce the CO2 output from the generation of energy. A lot of people, very substantial majority of the general population. But they want it to be done with them, not to them. They want to go along with the reasonable plan that sees it done over a time that they can afford it. And I think the media have something of a culpability here by saying, oh, gas boilers will be banned. People thinking that they will be forced to change the gas boiler that is sitting in their house rather than in 20 years' time when it needs replacing. They might not be able to get a gas one, but might have to get something else. And I think we need to have a political conversation as adults about what can be achieved, when it can be achieved by, and how that can be done fairly to particularly the lowest paid and the most vulnerable in our society. And I'm afraid that ULEZ is a good example of that conversation not being had, or being had in a tone which is not civilised and sensible and grown up. And instead we've got a scheme that means a carer or a cleaner who working on the minimum wage, 6 days a week, 5 days a week, using their own vehicle, could well be £62.50 a week, worse off. And they're just going to give up their job. It'll be as simple as that. They'll be out of work. They'll be on benefits. There'll be another drain on the taxpayer. And that is a consequence that I don't think has been thought of when the scheme was expanded.
Yeah, but hang on, John, because they might just give up their car, and surely that'd be a good thing. They'll go on public transport.
Have you tried being a carer with all the equipment you have to carry for 10, 15 different clients? You have to change your PPE for every appointment. You have to put that in a secure bin in the boot of your car. You have to, you have cleaning materials. You can't take that on public transport. It's simply impractical. And the blinkered view, and I do believe it is a blinkered view, that everybody can take a bicycle or can use public transport is, well, it is that. It is blinkered. Not everybody can. And as I say, you have to take people along this journey with you if you are going to achieve what we want to achieve. And as I say, there's a lot of support for achieving it. I think there's also a lot of fear and a lot of concern about what that means for individual households in terms of the costs they might face. And the gas price hike, which has caused a lot of problems and a lot of hardship in the last few weeks, and is going to cause quite a lot of hardship over the next year or two as those higher prices have to be passed on to customers. You know, that's going to bring it home to people that this transition that we're trying to make has got to be planned. It's got to be done in a way which doesn't impact on the poorest in society. And, you know, we've had to borrow half as much money as we borrowed to fight the Second World War in relative terms to deal with a COVID pandemic. We have to get the public finances back in some semblance of order in order to be able to support any moves towards a greener environment.
So that is Councillor John Moss from Stop ULEZ. But it's going ahead on Monday, Martin. The protest apparently is happening at Elephant and Castle, where the convoy of vehicles who do not intend not to pay the ULEZ charge, diesels are less than, more than 3 or 4 years old, over to Thamesmead, apparently. But I mean, you know, this, do you think there's any chance that this might actually, because I mean, this whole idea of can't pay, won't pay, I think was used at the same time as the re-hiking up of fares after the Ken Livingstone experiment, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, it did, but it was actually copied from Italian practice, actually. Well, I hear what he's saying there. I mean, was he a member of a political party?
Yeah, he's a Conservative MP, Moreton Forest. Yeah.
He's not an MP, he's a councillor.
No, he's a councillor, yeah.
All right. Well, what I'd say to him is I hear what you're saying there, and I think that we do have to have an adult conversation about
why
this.
Why is it the Conservative MP is sticking up for the poor?
Well, that's what he's claiming to stick up for the poor. Whether he is or he isn't is another matter.
Well, you
isn't
think
it?
It's okay for, what is it, £60 a week times 52 for these poor people?
No, am I going to get. Yeah, we've just heard a lot of him. Do you want to hear me or not?
No, Martin, I'm saying, you know, why is it? I'm asking you that question, which is, I mean, you asked about his political party. Why is a Conservative sticking up for poorer drivers?
Well, all politicians claim that they're sticking up for the poor. Even the Conservatives claim they're sticking up for the poor. They're helping them in every way by forcing them to work, by, you know, stopping them being dependent on welfare and all the rest of it. I think it's interesting because a lot of those arguments are worth having. I think the speed at which you move is worth discussing, even if we agree on the goal. Now, when he came at the end, we've got to put the public finances back in order. A, we don't. There is a magic money tree and everybody can see it. B, even if we are going to put the public finances back in order, which I don't accept, the way to do it is to tax the rich.
And then you can pay for
care workers to have a state-of-the-art vehicle, can't you?
$2 trillion
of these things are possible,
national debt,
provided. Yeah, but the Conservative Party in this country, of which he's a member, have actually impoverished the population in my lifetime. And then they turn around and say, we want to protect the poor from having their cars taken off.
Did New Labour play no part in
no,
that?
No, New Labour are part of the Conservative Party in this country, as far as I'm concerned. They had 13 years in power. They did nothing to end private finance initiative. They did nothing to build social housing. They basically betrayed what they're supposed to stand for. And then they invaded Iraq. And then, of course, we get the Tories back, the old Tories back. And what's happened in my lifetime is I was just reading that since 1959, the Tories have been in power for many, many years in this country, but they never won a majority of the popular vote in that time. So throughout my lifetime, I was born in 1959, I've lived under Tory governments for most of that time, and New Labour governments, which I classify as Tory, and they have never won a majority of the popular vote. That wouldn't be acceptable in Ireland.
Okay, just running through some international stories before we close. Biden says the Americans are going to come to Taiwan's defence if it's attacked by China.
Well, that's very unwise of him to say that.
It's a little bit like the Americans saying that they will come to Israel's defence if they start a war down there.
Yeah, well, I mean, Scott Ritter, who had on the previous weeks, pointed out that if China decided to take over Taiwan, there is nothing that the Americans could do to stop them short of nuclear war. So saying things like that doesn't help anything. Don't forget that the Americans have already agreed in 1972 that Taiwan is ultimately part of China.
Well, apparently, quite a lot of Democrats want to give Biden war powers over Taiwan.
Well, this is dangerous. And this means that we could end up with a nuclear war, which will make all this argument about ULEZ and climate change pretty irrelevant.
Also, Israel is resuming practicing attacks on Iran.
Yes, well, I mean, they've also carried out attacks within Syria. But they're gearing up for a war. People should be aware of that.
Absolutely.
That they want a war with Iran. Do listeners want a war with Iran? Does the Boris Johnson government want a war with Iran?
Twiddling their thumbs.
Because that's what's going to happen next.
Sticking themselves to the M25 need to understand that Israel has just okayed $1.5 billion for a potential attack on Iran.
Yeah. It's a question of what the most serious crisis we face is. I mean, this is where I think about Greta Thunberg, and you feel like saying, do you know that the Prime Minister of Italy was murdered in 1979 by NATO? Do you realise that the Breivik attack in Norway, not far from you, was probably carried out by Gladio? Do you realise that the former Prime Minister of Sweden, Olaf Palme, was probably assassinated by NATO? And you're not being assassinated because you're on message as far as those people are concerned.
Okay, finally, another horrendous piece of news. The United States has deployed its B-1 bombers to Diego Garcia. Is that obviously projecting power towards China?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of breastbeating. I mean, the Chinese are rolling their eyes because, in actual fact, if it comes to a fight, they are definitely going to win on their home turf. So I don't know why anybody's imagining anything else can happen. There was another thing that the Financial Times were reporting that they'd launched a hypersonic missile, and they were pushing this idea that they got a hypersonic missile. The Chinese said, no, this is a spacecraft that we've developed, and it's nothing. It's got no missile aspects to it. And
well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, they would say that. But the point is, the Russians have got hypersonic missiles already. They'll probably share the technology with the Chinese. The West is way behind in that, and all it does is underline the mutually assured destruction doctrine, which is anybody who starts a nuclear war will kill everybody, and everybody needs to understand that, and that will make all of our arguments about all of these things irrelevant.
Well, the US have also been talking about deploying their first hypersonic missiles.
They're talking about it, but they haven't developed them.
No?
They say they are. What they're trying to do is, what they want is to spend loads of money developing hypersonic missiles to compete with the Russians. And the Chinese are further down the line, but they've got Russian support. The point is, everybody's got more than enough nuclear weapons to destroy the other side. The Chinese strategic doctrine is that we're not going to get drawn into a nuclear missile arms race with the Americans. We have got sufficient to destroy America, and we're upgrading that because to make sure we have got sufficient, and that's all we need.
Lieutenant General Neil Thurgood, who oversees Army Rapid acquisition efforts, likened the four-year timeline to design, test and build a hypersonic weapon to the space race of the 1950s. But they've already lost it, haven't they?
Yeah, the Russians have already got them.
Yeah.
Too late.
Okay, so we'll wind up this week looking at the horrific assassination, I would call it, a political killing of Sir David Amess this time last week, Friday afternoon last week. This is the Conservative MP who would have been speaking in Tuesday's debate about the coronavirus lockdown law being renewed for another 6 months. But before we hear this clip, Martin, what do you think about this idea of Manchurian candidates? The idea that you can actually train somebody to go in and do a killing and basically not know anything about it, forget about it, in a kind of hypnotic state.
It's pretty clear that MK Ultra, people can look this up with any search engine. It's certainly possible. Of course it is.
Okay, we're going to hear, this is Conspiracy Classics number 15. This week our final clip is Laurent Guillenot. And this documentary, I found it up on the internet, downloaded it, and literally by the time I went back to it the day after, it had been deleted. So it's a fascinating, it's called, the actual documentary is called Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers by Laurent Guillenot. And here he talks about the whole idea of Sirhan Sirhan, the hypnotized assassin Do you want to say anything quickly about that? Because that was definitely a theory that emerged pretty much straight away, yeah, that this guy was somehow hypnotized.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it's the same as the guy who killed John Lennon. We definitely know they can do this, and it's the Israeli fingerprint on these things is there, but it's not just them, is it? There's plenty of people in the deep state in the West who aren't Israelis.
We know that in the 1960s, American military agencies were experimenting on mental control. Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, son of Hungarian Jews, directed the infamous CIA MKUltra project, which, among other things, was trying to answer questions like, can a person under hypnosis be forced to commit murder? According to a declassified document dated May 1951. We also know that Ciaran was attending meetings of occultist circles, practicing mental experiments, and this may have created opportunities to submit him to hypnotic programming. Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman has recently revealed that in May 1968, the month preceding Robert Kennedy's assassination, the Aman, the Israeli military intelligence, was planning to assassinate Yasser Arafat by hypnotically programming a Palestinian. The idea was proposed by a Navy psychologist named Binyamin Shalit, who claimed that, quote, if he was given a Palestinian prisoner, one of the thousands in Israeli jails, with the right characteristics, he could brainwash and hypnotize him into becoming a programmed killer. He would then be sent across the Jordan, join the Fatah there, and, when the opportunity arose, do away with Arafat. End of quote. The proposal was approved. Shalit selected a 28-year-old Palestinian from Bethlehem, whom he judged easily suggestionable. The operation failed, but it proved that in 1968, precisely, Israel was experimenting methods of assassination identical to the one used against Robert Kennedy.
So that's a clip from the Conspiracy Classics number 15, that is Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers by Laurent Guillenot, the French writer. But, I mean, this whole idea of hypnotizing an assassin, Martin, it was filmed, The Manchurian Candidate was about it, but it seems pretty clear that this is a possibility.
It's not even a possibility, it's definitely possible. And it's almost definitely been used.
You can almost select the characteristics of the type of person that you want to be the person who can be blamed for this. And then pick somebody from amongst a whole, you know, selection of, you know, usually these sorts of people are, you know, maybe a little bit unstable in some way.
That's right.
Then they're programmed.
That's right. An ex-friend of mine who was, Polish, she was in the University of Lublin, and one of her lecturers used to work for the SB, which is the Polish Security Services, before the communist, the collapse of the communist regime. And he was chatting to her before a lecture, and he said, I'll show you some of the things we learned how to do. And he said, when the rest of them come in, I'll make Marek sit at the back, I'll make Agnieszka sit next to so-and-so, and so-and-so will go and open the window. And they all came in, and they all did exactly as he had said. And anyway, the lecture ended, and she went up to him at the end and said, well, that was pretty impressive. I didn't see how you did that, but you did it. And he said, yes, well, that's the sort of thing we were taught how to do. I said, well, how do I know that you are not doing that to me? He said, yeah, but the other thing we were taught is that there are sheep and there are wolves. You and your family are wolves. We couldn't try and program you, and we wouldn't try. If you've got to choose the right subjects if you want to do that.
Fascinating. Well, time to sign off now. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, you can get in hold of me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details. Do please send me interviews and story tips, etc., via thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My book, after 30 years of research into the dodgiest ever deals done between the Allies and the Nazis in the last 8 months of World War II, the creation of the Bilderbergers, and the links back to the disastrous Battle of Arnhem portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far is out in paperback, price £15, including postage. You can get that on eBay. Also, my anthology on secret government from Cromwell to the assassination of Princess Diana. It's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. You can get them on eBay and The Siege of Heaven ebook, and links to them all via www.bilderberg.org, my old site. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen Show and over at Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. I think he's been putting that on Saturdays too, actually. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, please let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.